Support for Boston Public Radio comes from North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org. And Safety Insurance, offering auto insurance policies designed to help for when the worst happens. You can ask an independent agent about safety insurance. Safety Insurance. We'll help you manage life's storms.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Halloween isn't for another month. Yet the ghosts of the 2016 election are lurking everywhere. From the eerie similarities the Trump-Ukraine affair has with Russia's dirt-digging mission on Hillary Clinton, to the State Department investigating Clinton's emails to Clinton herself out and about calling Trump an illegitimate president. We take on these and other headlines on today's politics. It's been 1 year since the murder of columnist Jamal Khashoggi, and the Crown Prince still denies he had anything to do with it. We talked to Charlie Sennett about this and more. And then we open the lines and take your calls during our daily impeachment inquiry.
Hit TV shows House of Cards, Roseanne, and Transparent had to kill off their lead characters after their star actors were fired for objectionable behavior. But Transparent has gone beyond and doing without Jeffrey Tambor's lead character. The show's series finale went out on a Technicolor musical, as messy and original as the series itself. Bob Thompson joins us for that on Boston Public Radio. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Good.
Oh, good. Okay. Trump's efforts to discredit Joe Biden have backfired on him with an impeachment inquiry, but did he succeed in hurting Biden's candidacy anyway? Biden's dropping in the polls. His campaign is sending out distress signals, asking networks to stop putting Rudy Giuliani on the air. And some of Biden's top financial backers are mulling the idea of creating a super PAC to independently defend Biden. And even that could backfire by giving Senator Warren the opportunity to decry big money in politics. Joining us to take on this, Trump's latest impeachment inquiry outbursts and other political headlines, are Adam Riley and Joanna Weiss. Joanna's a GBH contributor, journalist, editor of Experience, a magazine published by Northeastern University, and a critic of Downton Abbey. Adam Riley is a reporter for WGBH News, and along with Peter Kadzis, co-hosts the Scrum Politics podcast. Adam, Joanna, it's great to see you both.
Hey, guys.
So, Adam Riley, we'll start with you. It's right now, this whole impeachment inquiry is very partisan. There are a handful of Republicans who stepped out, including our former governor, saying that he's troubled by the allegations against the president. But really, it's still Dems one side, Republicans the other side. Is this going to change, do you think? Or what does it take it to change?
You know, before this started, when impeachment was still a hypothetical, I thought that the numbers that we saw with more people opposing it than favoring it were kind of baked in, just given the way the media landscape works today. You'd hear proponents of impeachment say, well, with Watergate, support grew as it started and then progressed. And I always thought, well, there wasn't a Fox News in Watergate. But it's been interesting to see, I don't know how many polls it is now, it's got to be a half dozen or so that have come out since this particular storyline got rolling, even prior to the official launch of the impeachment inquiry. And support seems to be increasing. And I got to say, I don't know that the president does himself any favors when he tweets that Adam Schiff should be arrested and charged with treason, or that we're
which
marching
is punishable
towards civil
by
war.
Death, by
yeah.
the way.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's to your point, Jim, I think that's incitement to violence. So I actually do see more potential for flux than I did a month ago.
Yeah, I would like to think that Trump is making it harder and harder for Republicans with every tweet and utterance that is kind of, outside the Constitution. So far, though, I mean, you know, people like Mitt Romney, ever the profile and courage, are, you know, kind of hedging their bets still. And it's still interesting to see Republicans kind of going on TV and trying to kind of ride some of the twists and turns, you know, and what Trump's trying to do here with everything that he's saying and with kind of pushing through, not just talking about Joe Biden incessantly, but resurrecting the idea of Hillary Clinton's emails, is to try to cast this sort of idea that everyone in politics is corrupt, that he's not the only potentially corrupt one.
Yeah. You know what I think is troubling, though, and I am not a fan of the president, but when you see his henchmen go out, Stephen Miller, henchman in chief, Jim Jordan, who is a big apologist for Trump, Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader in the House, none of them, they're just dancing. When they're asked the question by the reporter, okay, so is it okay with you that the President of the United States seeks a foreign government's involvement in the election? They dance. They don't answer the question.
And then they make up facts. Do we have this great exchange, Tapper, which most of you have probably seen. This is CNN's Jake Tapper doing, I guess you could call it, a live fact check on Representative Jim Jordan. He's the guy from Ohio, Republican. After Jordan makes accusations about Joe Biden and his son, Hunter, first voice is Jordan, second is Tapper.
I'm just telling you what happened. Joe Biden called up and said, fire this prosecutor or you're not getting
in. No, you're suggesting that Biden called for the prosecutor to be fired to protect
and
his
president,
son.
And president,
that's not what happened.
And President Trump says, oh, can you help me figure out what happened in the 2016 election? After all,
you know, Congressman,
Democrats just put our country through 3 years of this when there was a false accusation. He can't do that, Biden can do what he
I want
can.
You to take a listen to Vice President Mike Pence when he was governor running for vice president, saying that it is a principle of the United States that foreign governments are not supposed to get involved in American elections. That once was a principle of the United States. But now, no, it's not, because the president is calling for Ukraine to investigate his rivals.
Jake, you're missing the fundamental point here.
I'm not missing anything.
I thought Tapper was great, by the way, and it is so necessary for these guys to be prepared enough to be able to do that.
Chris Wallace from Fox News.
Was that with Miller? Was that with Miller?
Fantastic with Stephen Miller. Yeah, Chris Wallace is a great interviewer.
Quite a few of the Fox hosts, you know, besides the super, super partisan kind of entertainment hosts, have really been just as tough on the president and on the Republicans as anyone else.
Ed Henry got into it with Mark Levin the other day.
Yeah, what happened with that? I mean, the president was very upset about the Ed Henry interview with Mark Levin, who's a very conservative, I would say, conspiratorial.
Yeah, I would agree
with
that. I
mean, guy on the radio. I think he's on an AM station.
I think Henry was taking a similar tack to what we heard Jake Tapper take. And, you know, the president, as we know, has indicated that he sees Fox News as his team and kind of his personal media arm. And Henry wasn't playing along according to type, and the president didn't like it.
And when they keep saying, as Jordan kept saying, well, the whistleblower is a partisan bias, and Tapper to keep pointing out, we don't know who the whistleblower is yet. We know the New York Times has said he's a CIA guy, but we don't know. All these things. It's like the words I keep using again, partisan hit job, deep state operation.
The part that seems to stop them a lot when you hear these interviews is when it gets to the question of, well, if there was nothing wrong here, then why did they sock the records of the phone call immediately away into some sort of secret, safe, secure file cabinet, you know?
Yeah, that's a good
question.
And
nobody, and I've heard people, you know, well, it's a good question. Like, nobody can, no Republican even can answer that.
There is one point I feel like we should highlight here. I said that I see the potential for support for impeachment to grow as this progresses. One huge caveat there is that the Democrats need to have their act together and present this in a way that makes their case effectively. And I think that there is reason to wonder if they're going to be able to do that.
Well, I don't think it's reason to wonder. I think it's reason to doubt.
I mean, you're right. I agree with you.
I naively assumed. I said this in Greater Boston last week. I don't even know who I was talking to, frankly. Whoever I was talking to last week. And Catherine Clark, who obviously is one of the leading Democrats in the House, is with me tonight on television. I assumed naively that, one, because Nancy Pelosi was upset with Jerry Nadler for using the word impeachment before she said he could, that judiciary would not be the point committee, which it apparently is. Six committees
feed into it.
But I'm wrong. It is the appoint committee.
I thought it was going to be Schiff.
No, I believe it's judiciary. But in any case, it's going to be six committees funneling into one. I naively assumed they'd pick one of those special committees. They'd pick I've said this on the air before, so my apologies, a competent messenger who was appealing in lots of ways, could explain things in really simple terms. Because the beauty of this versus Mueller, an answer to what a lot of people are saying, Mueller is fairly complex issue, even if he had done a good job, which he did not. This is about as straightforward as you can possibly get if you keep it simple, stupid.
So maybe one thing you don't do is when you're kicking off the hearing, you don't offer a ramped up paraphrase.
The mafia thing?
Yeah. You resist. And I know hindsight's 20/20, but obviously that has backfired on Schiff. I also was struck in that intelligence hearing at how they kept going after McGuire on his, you know, the way he chose to bring this thing forward. And that's legitimate to ask about, but they were turning him into the villain when what they wanted to do was turn the president.
And now we find out
the issue is what the president did, not what.
Well, we just learned. I mean, I just learned that McGuire really had no choice because of the way the law is written. Because the CIA lawyer that went in with the whistleblower's complaint before he was the whistleblower, his just regular complaint, did the same thing. You know, like the fox guarding the hen house and counting the number of hens. But apparently, they were hamstrung.
Well, you know, Pelosi spoke, I think, in Texas over the weekend,
she
laid out what is her approach to messaging. And it's basically to say, look, you know, we didn't want to do this. We had no choice in the end because this one was so obvious. And so it's a somber.
Yeah,
and
you know, it was obvious that you were losing your Democrats, that the Democrats were leading when you weren't. And she had to come along for the ride. No, Pelosi defenders don't like to hear that. But I would argue if you read the 10 obstruction of justice counts in the Mueller thing, some of them were just as compelling. Maybe not as simple as this, but she was losing her own party.
Oh, there was huge pressure on her. But you can also make an argument that she knew that as much damning information might have been in the Mueller report, it was really hard to sell that to the American public.
Maybe
this has got to be something you can sell simply, and you can't start tossing in emoluments and Mueller, and you know, you have to really, like you said, keep it simple.
Which doesn't say much for the American people.
Maybe
I mean,
they I don't agree with that.
Oh, I do.
People are busy, Marjorie.
I mean, there's a Jim. I think it's your civic obligation to pay attention.
Lindsey Graham did not read the Mueller report. Do you think the average busy person is going
to
read it?
You didn't have to read the Mueller report. You just didn't understand what the Mueller report said. It was easy enough to figure that out.
One problem I do think, I mentioned the existence of Fox as being very different than what we had going on when Nixon was impeached. But there's also the way we all consume information today. I mean, I swear we all have attention deficit disorder, or at least I know I do. I mean, just being online all day, checking Twitter constantly has made it harder for me to just read a book for pleasure.
And that's without all the food tweets even, right?
And baby animals. That's really hard to resist. But you know, can we get for a second to this thing that you touched upon, Adam, a minute ago? Here is the tweet that a lot of people are talking about and should be talking. This is the president retweeting a tweet from this extremist minister from, I think, Texas. I have visited nations ravaged. Oh, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. I don't actually have it in front of me. The Civil War thing, saying it's going to lead to a civil war. Trump retweeted this thing. He then says, as one of you said, that Adam Schiff, I think it was this morning, has committed treason. Most people know treason is punishable by death. On and on. We've already lived through. Marjorie and I went to Comet Ping Pong Pizza in Washington, where a gunman came, remember, because he was convinced that Hillary Clinton had a sex slave trade in the basement of the restaurant. He came with a loaded gun and shot into a crowded restaurant. This is so dangerous what this guy is doing. It is unbelievable.
I mean, if you're going to be kind about it, you can say it's to some degree a difference of scale, right? I just remember back in the Clinton impeachment days when Hillary Clinton got up and said there's a vast right-wing conspiracy. Like that's, you know, the way that you approach it if you're a defendant in this kind of case is to say, look, it's all trumped up, it's political, they just hate me. I mean, that's the only thing that Trump can say. He's just saying it in a way that, again, I think
it's a difference of substance rather than scale. I mean, if you say that your leading critic should be arrested and charged with treason, which is punishable by death, that can be read as an incitement to violence. And
yeah, I mean, it's extra constitutional, you could say.
I actually wonder if there is anything that the president could tweet at this point that would lead Jack Dorsey and Twitter to freeze his account even temporarily.
That's a wonderful point.
We may find out.
Way.
I mean, it's already getting pretty ugly. It's going to get, I think, uglier.
My guess
is Twitter won't do anything. By the way, one thing I want to throw in here, Charlie Baker very quietly said he backed the impeachment inquiry, which is probably worth noting.
Two governors, the Vermont governor and Baker, and the two Republican governors.
Baker, I think, understands. Has not been eager to weigh in on national political matters. But in this case, for him to do that is noteworthy.
Can we talk about the presidential race for a minute, which has totally disappeared? I mean, it seems to me the two problems for the Democrats running for president is, one, you take a back seat because impeachment is everything. I don't know how long that's going to last, but for the time being. And two, because the only thing you're ever asked about, other than taking selfies, is where are you on impeachment. It adds to the notion that this is, getting back to Marjorie's first question, a totally partisan exercise when all you hear from a presidential candidate, even if he or she is trying to talk about something else, is about where they are on the impeachment inquiry. How much of a problem, if it is a problem, is this whole thing for the Democrats trying to beat Trump?
I think it's a problem for them, and I think it's a problem potentially for the Democrats in Congress, because if this impeachment inquiry, even if there are articles of impeachment filed, assumption is it stops in the Senate, right? Like and Trump remains president and he remains a candidate. And then what do the Democrats have to show for themselves? They want to be making the case to the American public that maybe isn't as obsessed with an impeachment inquiry, that they are moving the needle on health care, that they are doing things about the economy, that they're trying to do something about guns, you know, that everything, impeachment just sucks all the energy out of anything the Democrats can do or say they're doing. And that could be a problem.
You know, I'm sorry, Adam, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think if you look at the Democratic presidential field, you mentioned this or alluded to this in your intro. I think it's worst for Biden, because even if you think that Republicans are consistently misrepresenting what happened with him and his son, and I think it's fair to say that they are, you still know, if you're a Democratic voter who's weighing who you're going to back, that this is going to be the line of attack against Biden. And then if you imagine, say, Elizabeth Warren, you know, maybe backing her as opposed to Biden, she probably looks a little bit better. I also think that she has been so effective over the course of this campaign at making her argument for, what's her phrase, big structural change. I can't remember how she puts it, that she might be more capable than a lot of the other Dems at transcending this noise and continuing with the argument that she's been pressing.
Corruption. You know, I'm going to repeat some
big themes, right?
Wait, say it again.
Corruption has been.
Corruption has. You're right. That's a good point.
The system is rigged.
I'm going to repeat something I said in front of Julia Kayyem the other day, and she almost bit my head off, suggesting I was engaging in a moral equivalency, which, if I was, I surely did not intend to. Bob Kuttner was with us the other day. He had just written a book about 2020 and how an economic progressive is needed, not just a Democrat, but an economic progressive in 2020. And he made the point, he has another piece, I don't even know where it's appearing, saying this whole Ukraine thing is a huge problem for Biden. Not for the reasons you're just mentioning or Trump is mentioning. He said, but when the campaign gets going further, and I'm paraphrasing what Robert Kuttner had to say, is when Republicans or their supporters on Fox News or whoever it is are saying, you know, whose son was it that was taking $50,000 a month from an energy company in Ukraine in the middle? I think that is far more damning to Biden than, frankly, the whole notion, this corruption notion, which is confusing to a lot of people. There's the truth, and then there's the argument that he was trying to kill an investigation into his kid, which he was not doing. Isn't that a problem? That he is a grown son, he's an adult, but he's taken $600,000 a year as a board member of an energy company in Ukraine?
I mean, again, for a public that's not going to dig into the details and might not read the last three paragraphs of every Washington Post story that explains that it has never been proven that he's done, that there's been any wrongdoing. No, I think it contributes to, you know, a sort of shadow over the Biden campaign. The other problem is that Biden seems to have a lot of trouble articulating a response to that, and to really a response to a whole lot of different challenges he's faced. I mean, his campaign wouldn't even put him on the Sunday shows this week. They apparently offered somebody else that the shows, you know, some other surrogate that the shows refused to take. I mean, if he can't get out there, and honestly, Hillary Clinton had this problem a little bit too, not being able to get out and really articulate a clear response that everyone could understand about the email situation. And you know, and the email accusation was probably, you know, equally
specious.
She's
willing to go on the shows now, by the way.
Oh, now she's all over it. But, you know, he can't make that argument. He can't get past it.
But there is the other rejoinder, which is all three of the Trump children are profiting wildly from the presidency of the United States. Ivanka's gotten how many patents from China and all these deals, and the sons with the golf clubs and the hotels. And
the only problem is with that, I agree with you completely, it's in the rearview mirror. There's been so much about corruption by the president and his family already. It's sort of like, and I'm not defending this response, I'm just stating my view of it. We knew that already. We knew that the kids are corrupt. We knew that the president doesn't play by the same rules. There's a totally different standard, unfairly, that's applied to this guy.
I think it's also possible that Hunter Biden generally, as opposed to Hunter Biden getting a lot of money for sitting on the board of that gas company, is a big problem for Joe Biden. That New Yorker piece that ran a couple months ago got into things like, you know, his issues with chemical dependency and abusive drug use. He is
the widow of Bo.
Yeah, that's
the widow
too.
Of Bo. Yeah,
but he waited a couple of minutes.
He is. I think you could say a loose cannon. He is a troubled individual. And, you know, I think it goes beyond just the Ukraine stuff. So,
you know, last thing before we leave this, then we'll go to take a break, go to local politics. I mentioned that I wasn't being rhetorical about Hillary Clinton now being willing to go on the talk shows. Here she is. I think this is on CBS, but wherever it was, here is Hillary Clinton.
I believe he knows he's an illegitimate president. He knows. He knows that there were a bunch of different reasons why the election turned out the way it did. And I take responsibility for those parts of it that I should. But, Jane, it was like applying for a job and getting 66 million letters of recommendation and losing to a corrupt human tornado.
Is this helpful or is it not?
I think relitigating the 2016 campaign is not helpful. Mm-hmm. It's just not.
Adam?
I am with Joanna there. I think if any Democratic candidates were watching that, they were wishing Hillary Clinton would be quiet and not make that appearance or similar ones.
Although we should point out that the State Department is relitigating the 2016 campaign. Because
they interviewed, what, 130 people?
There is
That's crazy.
That in August, coincidentally, right around the time all this stuff in Ukraine blew up, the State Department revived its earlier efforts to go back and scare the hell out of a lot of people that work for the State Department by retroactively reclassifying emails that they did not think were
classified. I have to say, I need someone to explain that to me. I read the same. I don't understand how you can – I can understand how you can retroactively classify something. I don't understand how you can be in trouble for having – sent an unclassified email to a certain unprotected account if you didn't and had no reason to know it was classified at the time.
Because I think, and this is one of the scariest things that Robert Kuttner said to us, that the president has obviously already co-opted the Department of Justice and his, I would say, I think it's fair to say corrupt at this point, Attorney General, Deep Six, this whistleblower letter. And it would seem to me that the State Department is now doing the president's bidding as well.
Mike Pompeo is a very loyal servant.
Yeah, and Kuttner's argument was that is if Trump is reelected, next, is it the CIA? Is it the FBI?
And it gets even worse in the departments where he has dozens of tentacles.
All around, I mean, that he's been able to co-opt these two agencies already. Who knows what happens if he's reelected?
No, it's cause for concern, and it's a challenge for the Democrats. Because then, I mean, I just said they need to run on issues, and I think they do. But it is really difficult, I think, to not want to go back to this argument that this is a really problematic presidency.
And, well, you know, one last thing about this. I have a feeling you're not going to like this, Marjorie, but I'll do it anyway. What happens when, in a month or two, when Moscow Mitch, as he doesn't like to be called, is saying the reason I'm not we all know this was not his reason. The reason I'm not taking up gun control is because I have to start preparing for impeachment hearings. If there's an impeachment that the Democrats started, I was ready to do. I was talking to the president. I was ready to do background checks.
I think the Democrats,
I have no time.
At that point, would point out that they had already passed a bill on gun control and it's ready for Mitch McConnell to take up. I mean, you know, again, I think we can't let ourselves off the hook all the time. Everybody's got time to watch Netflix and Showtime and a million things on Amazon.
Actually, that's not true. You and I have enough time to do that. The average person doesn't sit home and watch Netflix and Showtime.
You don't have to do that. You can read a newspaper, one newspaper, for 15 minutes a day and know what's going on.
The tricky thing here, I think, is that we're living in such a time of uncertainty, and it is so frightening that we have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next and where we're going to be in 6 months, that I think a lot of people have decided that they need to sort of take very small bites at the information apple, that there's only so much of this they can tolerate on a daily basis. They're going to, you know, maybe check the headlines, but they're not going to hunker down and immerse themselves in it just as a coping mechanism.
We've had people in here, Marjorie, who are unbelievably smart, including a Pulitzer Prize winning author who's saying she turns off the news the second Donald Trump's name comes up for her mental health, as you suggested a minute ago.
It's like the hide under a blanket approach.
Exactly. I'm not defending it.
Well, I think my fellow Americans should suck it up.
Okay, fine.
Okay, we're going over the latest headlines with Adam Riley and Joanna Weiss. We're going to talk about some local headlines when we return on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics with Adam Riley and Joanna Weiss.
So The Zoning Board of Appeals in Boston appears to run in a way that most other zoning boards of appeals around the country don't run, according to this story by Milton Valencia today in The Globe and Tim Logan, where you have all these developers with clear conflict of interest on the Zoning Board of Appeals.
I got to give a shout out to our colleague, Isaiah Thompson, because he actually got at this particular angle a few days ago. Craig Galvin, who resigned from the Zoning Board of Appeals, is a realtor who was approving certain projects on the ZBA, projects that needed a variance, otherwise they weren't going to be as lucrative. And then down the road, he was helping sell spaces in these projects, which is not illegal, but on a common sense level, just, you know, it doesn't make any sense at all. It's not how a watchdog system should work. And yet it is how it was working at the ZBA.
Well, you know, not to bring national politics into everything, but when people think, oh, all politicians are corrupt, so I'm going to hide under a blanket, this is the kind of thing that makes them think that. You know, when things are happening on the local level that really affects people in their neighborhoods, that matters in their day-to-day lives, and they see something, they see a situation where they don't have access to the same kinds of decision-making and the same kinds of kind of dealing that they see these insider people have, they think the whole system's corrupt. Why should I trust anyone? I hate government. Maybe I'll vote for,
While Adam gave Isaiah credit, I want to give Marjorie a little credit for broaching with the mayor when he was on a couple of Fridays ago the topic that both the Globe and GBH News were dealing with, is having people who have their tentacles into the development community being those who guard the chicken coop. Or what did he say to you when you broached that with him? You don't remember? Good.
Remember,
okay, fine.
Trust me, you did.
But I do know this.
Say the notion is, why do you need people who are so enmeshed in the entities that they are regulating being the regulators, which
I think is a fair question. I think he said that's the way
I think he said that's where the expertise is, too.
But here's what they did at the end of this piece, which I thought was so important, went out and interviewed someone with expertise in this area and said that if a member of the Zoning Board of Appeals actively works in industries overseen by the board, they shouldn't be there. And in Boston, listen to this. Four of the seven seats are reserved for real estate agents, architects, construction contractors, and members of local building trades unions. That is not usual.
Can I? Joanna wants to get in here. I want to say one thing sort of in defense of the mayor, but then I also want to take a whack at the mayor. It was like this before he got here. It was like this under Tom Menino.
Yes.
I was going back to the Bay State Banner back in 2004, dug into the fact that the president of the ZBA, this guy Joseph Feaster, was representing a developer who was kind of running roughshod in Dorchester and Mattapan and Roxbury. He was representing these projects. Then when they'd come up for a vote at the ZBA, Feaster would recuse himself. But what are you going to do? He's the president of the body. And back then, Mayor Menino said, oh, okay, well, we're going to start, you know, ramping up ethics disclosures. We're going to take this a lot more seriously. 15 years on, not much has changed. It's also worth noting the mayor has said he's going to, you know, conduct a top-to-bottom review of the ZBA's practices, Blue Ribbon Commission, whatever phrases he used. I don't think we've gotten the results yet of that top-to-bottom review of the city's event planning process that was promised back in the wake of the Boston Calling indictments. That has yet to materialize.
Point.
So, you know, don't expect this one to be delivered anytime soon.
I mean, I don't think it's necessary to bar all architects forever from serving on the Zoning Board of Appeals. You know what I mean? I think it was, is it Lydia Edwards, was I reading right? Is planning to introduce an ordinance that would open up some seats or sort of designate some seats on that board to
She wants to get rid of people who work directly in real estate development.
Mm-hmm. And maybe open up some seats to other stakeholders mm-hmm. who might not have a seat on the board, you know, people who have, you know, community development or planning or sort of neighborhood planning.
She wants seats for renters, urban planners, fair housing and environmental experts.
Right. So, I mean, ensuring that there are a lot of points of view and perspectives represented on those boards in addition to the developers' interests seems like a good way to go.
See, I don't think you can have developers on the board at all. I just don't think you can, because they're making money by either helping their own future developments or by denying the developments of their competitors. It just can't
fly. The latter
fly.
Point is a very good point for those who say as long as they get rid of conflicts, you don't have to worry. But you make a very good point mm-hmm. about them voting no or leading the no charge.
And you know what else? You know what else? All we have to do is look around Boston, the mess we made of the seaport. And people fear we're going to make another mess over.
You don't like to go down to the seaport and just walk around on a Sunday?
and what could happen in Suffolk Downs? Yeah. And you look at this South Boston situation. I mean, geez, I think they could do a little bit better how they're developing South Boston too, don't they? It's not exactly Nirvana over there.
I'm trying to remember. It might have been Christina Quinn. I don't want to make this shout out to a colleague, but Christina described. She said that in the future, Boston will be all luxury condos and Davios. I think that was which is sort of the direction we do seem to be going.
You know what else is really depressing? That they're selling this condo in South Boston for $800,000.
That is crazy.
Oh, my God.
How about Bulger's old house for $3 million or whatever it was? Did you see that?
I saw that. That wasn't his house. That's where he killed everybody.
While
we're trashing Boston, can I just give a brief shout out to one thing that I think is going right, which is the Greenway? I was on the Greenway this weekend, and it's wonderful.
With those fountains.
Going by the fountain, and then the Trillium Beer Garden was packed, and there were dogs, and there were kids. And I mean, there is a way to do things right.
Before we leave, or actually before you leave, we're not leaving, before you leave, you know, Charlie Baker took a lot of heat for his first 5 years for not being a risk-taking guy, despite the fact that he probably has more political capital than any governor in recent years. He then does take a strong position on vaping. He's the only governor in the country that has done an outright ban, albeit for 4 months, and then they'll see where it goes. And now he's being savaged for having done something without arguably the proper process, et cetera. I don't know. I know there's a lawsuit about whether or not he violated whatever the emergency rules and regulations are. But I have to say, if he really feels as strongly about it as he says he does, I give the guy praise for acting if he believes it's a serious public health threat.
Yeah, that was a fascinating move and uncharacteristic, it's true. And as someone who, you know, I have kids who are kind of around that age where, you know, vaping really is a public health problem for kids. I mean, it is astounding to me that we sort of got this far, that this product just kind of flooded the market.
You know what it is? It's the fetish that we have for disruptive industries right now, where something comes along. Oh, hey, here's a new delivery mechanism. Yeah, let's put our hands together.
No, it's stunning. And I know there are adults who say, look, vaping really is helping me, and it helped me with medical situations, and it helping me get off of cigarettes. I mean, there's an argument for vaping, but I think you're right. The runaway train kind of got down the track so far with the flavored smoke.
I'm mystified by the backlash to what the governor did. I mean, this is really scary stuff. You're not talking...
if you owned a small business that has to shut down, you can understand that.
I can understand definitely why you would be frustrated. I still don't think that means the governor did the wrong thing. If you're looking at a product where a handful of uses could result in a potentially lethal mystery illness, you know, to me, all due respect to shop proprietors, that human life is way more important.
Well, maybe he's thinking, boy, if we had stopped the train on the tracks before the opioid thing got out of control. I mean, I'm not making an exact equivalence, but, you know, there's something that, again, like kind of ran down the highway and everyone was just prescribing opioids and all of a sudden we're in the middle of a public health crisis.
Okay, I have 30 seconds to say what's wrong with Downton Abbey. Go ahead.
I saw the Downton Abbey movie the first weekend. I wrote for Politico magazine. And I was astounded at how much the servants in Downton Abbey loved the aristocracy and wished that they could stay on in their feudal estate forever and ever and ever. So I wrote about that and why, even in this age of economic inequality, there might be an interest in servants and masters.
Beautifully done. It was a great piece, actually.
Thank you so much, you guys, for coming in. Joanna Weiss
is
a WGBH contributor, a journalist and editor of Experience, a magazine published by Northeastern University. Adam Riley is a reporter for WGBH News. And along with Peter Katsas, he co-hosts the Scrum Political Podcast, which I think is going to talk about Fall River's corruption.
I can't wait to read it.
Or listen to it. Adam Riley and Joanna Weiss, thank you very much. Up next, Charlie Sennett joins us to go over the latest news surrounding the Trump-Ukraine affair and the Saudi prince. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Mardrigan. Could Boris Johnson be exiting
Why do you laugh, Jim?
The prime ministership before the UK exits the EU. His opposition will likely finalize plans to bring him down in a vote of no confidence, and there are also calls for him to resign over corruption allegations from his time as London's mayor. It's Marjorie's favorite story of the day.
Oh, yes, it certainly is.
Here with us in Studio 3 for his take on this, where the accountability is 1 year after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered, and other global headlines. Charlie Sennett joins us. He's a news analyst here at GBH. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie.
Well, as Jim said, we'll get back to the Boris story in just a couple of minutes. A delicious Boris story. Yeah. But first, let's talk about this. The White House use of this secret system for stashing things like the phone calls between the president and the Ukraine president.
Yeah, a lot of reporting Friday and through the weekend on this. I thought NPR did a particularly good job of really reaching out to former secretaries of defense, former NSA officials, and basically getting consensus from Republicans and Democrats. Like, this has never been done before. This is not something that's normal to stash these documents away like that. Definitely not with the in the manner that it's been done by the Trump administration. So I thought it was an important thing to see this reporting taking shape and really coming to a consensus like, yes, we should be shocked. Yes, this is evidence of a cover-up. The only reason you would put all these things in such a vault is because you're trying to hide them. Because even really important cables, like in the wake of September 11th, they were not put in a vault where no one else could ever see them. Like, you have to have your team have access to documents so that you can monitor them and you can assess them.
So, Charlie Sennett, I think I said in the opener, maybe we said when we knew you were coming.
Yeah.
I believe, is it Wednesday, is the one-year anniversary of the execution, dismemberment of a guy who you know, Khashoggi.
Yeah.
And last night on 60 Minutes, the Crown Prince said, hey, I didn't know anything about it. And Frontlines got a two-hour documentary that
Martin
just
Smith,
begun to watch.
Amazing.
He's joining us tomorrow, actually.
Oh, good. I can't wait to
and
talk to him.
The little bit that I've seen is brilliant, as his work always is. Again, that'll air tomorrow night. It's clear that at the end of the day, the president's given him a pass. He's given himself a pass. No accountability for what essentially everybody outside of Donald Trump acknowledges he ordered.
Exactly. And now in both interviews, the Frontline interview, which they released the key findings over the weekend.
Yeah, they did.
To get ahead of 60 Minutes, which I was proud of our local team for doing this amazing documentary, but also being smart about getting the news out there and shaping the agenda. And on both the Frontline interview with Martin Smith and on the 60 Minutes piece last night, same messaging coming out of Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, which is to say that he takes full responsibility now for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but that he had nothing to do with it and he didn't order it. He's just willing to, in a very sort of way a prince might, take responsibility.
That's right.
And I think it's too little. It's too late. I think he got caught. I think he tried to cover it up. And I think they killed an American journalist, or at least a journalist who's a resident of the United States of America, working for the Washington Post, one of the most important voices in Saudi Arabia, a guy who I used to go see regularly, as you pointed out, Jim. When you went to try to understand Saudi Arabia, he was the first person you went to. And they didn't just kill him. They murdered him in the most brutal fashion with a bone saw. So this is not, I don't think, going to go over. You can't go on to 60 Minutes the way Bill Clinton did and say, hey, I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
Like, I think this is not one to let go of. And I think the context...
By whom, though? Who is not going to let go of it?
Well, I think we can't. I think we as journalists can't ever forget what that regime did to a journalist. And I think we can't, as journalists, stop asking tough questions about it. And I think this lands in the context, of course, of the anniversary, as you pointed out, the anniversary of his murder inside the consulate in Istanbul. But it also lands right in the middle of a crisis with Iran. And the Saudis are very much looking to the United States for support as an ally in the region. And I think they're trying to be contrite. And I think at a time when they need us, we need to be sure they hear loud and clear that these kinds of human rights violations won't stand.
But, you know, it reminds me in some ways about going from the Mueller report right into Ukraine by the president.
Mm-hmm.
We've had all these stories about this horrible killing of Khashoggi.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this Declan Walsh story shortly after that,
right,
about this reporter being stranded in Egypt.
Great reporter, New York Times reporter, friend, used to work with The Guardian. I know him well.
Yeah.
Declan was in Egypt doing his job, working.
What happened?
Well, and they had gotten the State Department was given warnings that as a reporter who's been tough on the regime, that he was going to be arrested. Or detained and potentially arrested and put in prison. And in an Egyptian prison is no joke. And it's been typical when you're a journalist and you're working in a dangerous corner of the world and a brutal regime is coming after you, the State Department will let you know if they've been given a heads up. You might want to leave this country right now, or you need to get in here so that we can give you protection. That's the normal way of doing things to protect a free press in our country. What Arthur Sulzberger in his speech at Brown University shared, and an amazing speech, by the way, if you haven't heard it, about the climate we live in which the president of the United States is not only calling journalists the enemy of the people, but he's also, according to the speech by Sulzberger, conducting or presiding over a State Department where they withheld that information from the New York Times because they didn't really care, presumably, or maybe they felt he deserved it. Remember, Trump likes el-Sisi. He's an autocrat who gets his way.
Didn't he say it was his favorite dictator?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can't even laugh about this because Declan is one of the really, really one of the great reporters I know. He's Irish citizen.
And he was rescued by Ireland, by
and
the
so
way.
And so what they had to do was actually someone inside the State Department got this word out, and it was the New York Times got over to the Irish embassy, and it was Ireland that got the New York Times reporter out. Not our own country. That is disturbing.
Well, I mention it obviously because there's a pattern here about the Trump administration's attitude toward reporters.
Somewhere between contempt and cavalier is the spirit that this administration has toward a free press.
Okay, so I don't know how much of a historian you are of the prime ministership of the UK, but will Boris Johnson be known as the William Henry Harrison of... I don't mean that he'll die, but don't send me email. I think
he could be gone.
Was he there 30 days?
Week?
I think Harrison made it a month or something like that.
All right.
This is really...
Boris is really in it. Now, it's become... Hasn't this become like a kind of Masterpiece Theater episode? We could definitely do a sort of Netflix on, you know, inside.
So there's going to be a no confidence vote. And so then what happens if there's a no confidence vote? What threshold has to be reached essentially for him? And who does he get replaced by? Corbyn, who is also wildly unpopular.
Corbyn, the head of the Labour Party, would presumably have a chance to form his own coalition government if
he could go lie to the Queen too. So that should help.
if we see the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson forced out this week, it's going to be because they're going to replace him with an interim administration in order to secure a Brexit delay. He's going to fall on the sword of Brexit. He's going to be the most short-lived. I think, I'm pretty sure this will be history in the making in the UK. And I think, it's very hard to understand parliamentary politics if you're coming at it from an American perspective, because there's all kinds of horse trading that goes on. Things can happen. But the theory is that, yes, Corbyn might actually take and form his own government. He's really divisive. He's the opposition leader. He's got to picture him putting this together is a kind of puzzle I can't imagine really happening. But I don't know. I mean, hang on to your seats. We don't know where this episode of Brexit...
How soon is this no confidence vote happening this week or next week? It's imminent.
It's next week. They're reporting, but I think this week we got to know if this is going to start to take shape. So I'd say we'll know this week if it's going to happen.
The only reason Marjorie really wanted to discuss this no confidence vote is she could take it in another direction.
You wanted to get to the
take
Sunday
away,
Marjorie.
I wanted
Times
to get to
London.
The sordid tale about the same time all this is happening. He may be out in a week. Apparently, we learned this weekend that Jennifer Akuri, mm-hmm. Confided several years ago that she was having an affair with Mr. Johnson when he was the mayor of London, a relationship that began in 2012, when he was in the his second marriage at the time. He was 47. She was 27.
She's apparently a U.S. citizen?
She's a United States citizen. Okay. She's an American businesswoman. The problem for money-wise is that allegedly she received thousands of pounds from a government agency while he was making afternoon visits to the apartment where Ms. Akuri lived in East London while on breaks from his duties as mayor. And the article was illustrated with a photograph
I knew you'd
of
get
Ms.
there.
Akuri using a dancing pole. Like a stripper's
dancing. Wait, first
dancing
of all, you
pole.
Know, the Times of London is this beautifully packaged version of the New York Post.
Yeah.
It's a very...
It's a Murdoch paper.
It's a newspaper that looks prodigious, and it often has great reporting. They do really have some great reporters. But it is always looking for the big blockbuster scandal, and it just landed on
one. The picture
one.
Of the dancing pole.
It's
like
pretty
you
good.
See in a stripper.
But
box.
It is, again...
But that's not
another
all.
Episode
oh, there's more.
Of
not
Masterpiece
all.
Theaters, 12 Downing Street.
It's not all. The same week, can we learn it maybe out in the week?
Can we sorry,
about
10.
This,
yeah.
this
no, this is 12. This is next door.
With the dancing pole. He was also accused this weekend of squeezing the thighs of two women seated at either side of him in a private lunch. And one of the women said that he grabbed her high on the thigh, touching, quote, enough inner flesh beneath his fingers, unquote, to make her sit suddenly upright. Oh,
all right,
my
now why,
goodness.
All right.
These guys never
say
goodnight, stop.
Boris.
Well, so
guess what the prime minister's office said about it?
What?
Untrue.
Mm.
Of course.
I'm shocked. So the thing about British newspaper scandals is they come and go very quickly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
I don't know
the
timing that Boris
is not
gets,
so good for him,
no,
I would argue, in the middle of this.
Clearly. But I don't think it's the kind of thing that's going to – I don't think that will be what is responsible
no,
for the
it's
end
not. It's just
of
a
Boris
little,
Johnson's
you know,
career.
You know she's from Fall River. Do you know that, actually?
A little added color to the Boris travails, you know.
But
he's got a girlfriend now, so it's okay. He's not
so
married now.
Can we get back to the serious part of this for
oh, that thing
minute.
About the British government going into a collapse?
So if it, October 31st is the deadline for the hard exit, hard Brexit.
Okay.
So if – and where are we at? September 30th.
Wait, October 19th is the deadline.
I thought it was 31st. So okay, so it's sometime in October. But so – what happens to that?
Actually, it's the 19th is the deadline to ask for an extension.
Okay.
You're right about the 31st.
So what happens if there's a government in transition and these dates pass? Is Britain
Tim, you
automatically
ask me like, I can, like I actually would know what is going to happen with Brexit now. I mean, if we've learned one thing week after week, it's that anything can happen. It's that this is a roller coaster into, you know, the deepest depths of the future of this great country. I mean, it's really scary to see. We made a decision in as a country when we elected as a country Donald Trump. Many feel that we're hearing from people who didn't feel heard in our country and that they wanted to sort of roll a grenade into Washington and sort of blow everything up and say, let's just start all over.
Yeah.
Let's have a president who's going to take on the establishment. Both parties are broken. Let's do things the way we never have done them before. I mean, in a very American style, we came in and did this with literally a stun grenade. The British are in this decline, this slow slide into chaos that is hurting their economy, that is really undercutting their alliances with Europe, that is unraveling a 75-year history of building these alliances with the European Union and NATO. This is real. This is something that I'm always saying that I think that the British will survive. They will find a way to pull up their socks and get on with this, and they're resilient. And I keep saying that. And now I'm starting to wonder, in an age in which the news pings around as much as it is right now, I think they've done real damage to the institutions of their country, and it's getting to be a point where if you were an investor, would you invest in the UK right now?
It's looking a little shaky, I would say.
So at the same time that he may be removed from office, there may be a new president of Afghanistan, sort of under the radar, I would argue, maybe because of all that's going on in the rest of the world. What are the potential consequence. First of all, my understanding is even though the vote happened a couple of days ago,
it's going to take a while to count.
It's going to take a while to count them,
right?
So we're not going to know what are the range of possible options here, and what does it mean for the possibility of some sort of peace accord there?
So I think the good news is there was an election. The bad news is the turnout was low, even by the standards that they had set, which were low to begin with. The reason for that low turnout is fear. The Taliban have made it clear that they were going to attack polling places, and they did. They've made it clear that if you're found out to be someone who votes and you put your faith in that democratic system, that they won't look kindly on that. And in the provinces, which are many right now that the Taliban controls, there's a long memory there. They're going to remember who was where and when. And I think it's a real shadow being cast over a democracy that has tried to build itself up from the ashes of civil war and the post 9/11 war in Afghanistan. I still think that the country is better off with some of the democratic institutions that it has, and I do think it can go forward. As far as who's going to win, what's it going to mean? There's a dozen candidates who are vying for the presidency. The incumbent, Ashraf Ghani, and his deputy, Abdullah Abdullah, who used to be the foreign minister, are the front runners, and one of them will emerge. Both of them are very similar in their approach to the United States. I don't think it'll have any great new impact on a potential peace agreement with the Taliban and a potential pullback, finally, of U.S. troops and an ending of America's longest war.
You know, Charlie, we only have a minute left, but Marjorie and I didn't want to have you go without mentioning a piece you wrote about Tom Galloway. Can you give us 60 seconds on it?
Thank you for asking. Yep.
Take us to the site, too. So people
super, super quick. I would just say it was a day of really sad news at Ground Truth last week and really good news. The sad news was Tom Galloway's family held a memorial service for him. Tom is our first supporter of the Ground Truth Project and the first supporter of Report for America. Very successful Washington lawyer who grew up in Appalachia and wanted to give back to journalism and wanted to give back specifically in Appalachia. So he had funded our reporting from Africa to Appalachia, literally.
Wow.
Wonderful man, a great family, unbelievable cast of supporters came together around him, including three United States senators who were there at his family's gathering. Really has made an impact, tremendous supporter of journalism. The good news I wish Tom was with us to celebrate was that we also won an Emmy with Frontline. The Ground Truth Project and its partnership with Frontline. We got our first Emmy. Frontline wins them all the time. We're proud to be their partner. We were proud to have our film, The Last Generation, about climate change through the eyes of children in the Marshall Islands.
Oh, great. You deserve
Katie,
it. That
Katie
was great.
Worth, the reporter who did it, Michelle Meisner, amazing film. You can get them both on the groundtruthproject.org, the remembrance of Tom and The Last Generation and the news of its big win.
Congratulations to all of you.
Charlie.
Great. Thanks, Charlie.
Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you about President Trump's latest outbursts, citing treason, spying, and forecasting of a civil war. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
On Boston Public Radio, President Trump has opened another week of impeachment turmoil, unleashing a new round of attacks on his accusers, saying Adam Schiff should be arrested for treason, members of his own administration might be spying on him, and the outrageous tweet, quoting Fox News contributor and megachurch pastor Robert Jeffries, if the Democrats are successful in removing the president from office, which they will never be, it will cause a civil war-like fracture in this nation from which our country will never heal. Off his latest fusillade of invectives, we open the lines and ask you if the president's behavior runs the risk of inciting violence.
Bob Thompson joins us for his best and worst TV moments of the week. Then for Harvard, it's more money, more problems. How did the university's president, Larry Bacow, manage to compare donors to freed slaves? With a horrible analogy like that, it's a wonder he got high marks on his SATs. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Logan, Jim.
Logan, Marjorie, so President Trump ran as an anti-interventionist, making it clear he does not want to use the U.S. military to fight foreign conflicts. But off his Sunday evening tweet, it's clear he has no objections to using U.S. military for potential domestic disputes. Here he is retweeting Fox News contributor and evangelical pastor Robert Jeffress. Trump, a warning of a civil war. Here's the tweet. If the Democrats are successful in removing the president from office, and then Trump added a parenthetical, which they will never be, and then Jeffress continued, it will cause a civil war-like fracture in this nation from which our country will never heal. You can say this is Trump being Trump, but is Trump being Trump also deeply problematic? Just having a sitting president who threatens a civil war if Congress exercises its constitutionally authorized power concerning the numbers 877-301-8970. Does this kind of rhetoric have the power to incite violence and conflict? I would say it sure as hell has that potential. As we said with Adam Riley and Joanna Weiss earlier this morning, I believe it was this morning, he was tweeting that Adam Schiff, the House Chair of the Intelligence Committee, had committed treason. And most people
and fraud should be
are
investigated.
Aware, well, except unlike fraud, which is punishable potentially by prison time, treason is punishable by death. And I think the more he talks about this, the more nuts like that guy who drove up from South or North Carolina, remember this, to free the sex slaves in the basement of the Comet Ping Pong Pizza, where you and I went a couple of years ago, and by the way, brought a loaded weapon and shot that weapon in a crowded restaurant. Luckily, no one was hurt. This has great potential to incite violence. And I have to say, I want to give credit to, because we're often talking about the fact, you know, how is it that there's not one Republican who is concerned about the president of the United States either talking to a foreign leader about getting dirt on a potential opponent, that sort of thing. Here's the reaction to this retweeting of the Civil War reference by Adam Kinzinger, who's a Republican congressperson from Illinois. He's a decorated Air Force veteran. He served as a pilot in Iraq and Afghanistan. Here's what he tweeted. I have visited nations ravaged by civil war. Trump, I have never imagined such a quote to be repeated by a president. He was directing that comment to the president. I've never imagined such a quote to be repeated by a president. This is beyond repugnant. Again, that's Republican congressperson Adam Kinzinger. Who could disagree with that? I mean, who can disagree that in this incredibly polarized, tense world, we're going to talk to the reverends later about that that guy in New Jersey, the police chief in some small township, who said that
Trump is basically the last best hope for white people.
Right. This is the same police chief who banged the head of an 18-year-old black kid into a door jam, yeah. Metal door jam. You know, maybe he would have done it otherwise, but obviously he felt the president was some inspiration. This is dangerous stuff. It's one thing to defend yourself and say it's not true. There was nothing illegal or improper, as he says, a perfect call that I had with the Ukrainian president. But this kind of civil war talk, treason talk is real. And did you see now that there are two of his supporters. This is in the Washington Examiner, which is a conservative newspaper in Washington. Two of his supporters have offered a $50,000 reward for information about the national security whistleblower. And by the way, the Washington Examiner, which is a Republican, a conservative paper, mm-hmm. they themselves, in a past story, referred to these two guys as right-wing smear merchants. And these guys are essentially soliciting for $50,000 the outing of a guy whose identity, the whole point of the whistleblower law, and obviously the president of the United States doesn't understand this either, because he says he wants to meet with the whistleblower, is to have the whistleblower outed and potentially put at incredibly great risk. Can you imagine if Trump's supporters knew who this guy or woman was, how much trouble would this guy be in terms of his physical well-being? I'd say a lot.
I would say a lot. The lawyer himself has said he has fears for his client's safety after the president was talking about whistleblowing be something close to being a spy and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it is scary, but I guess I'm heartened that there are at least a handful of Republicans in these early days that are stepping up and saying you can't say there's no there there because there is.
It's a really small number, Marjorie.
It's a small number. It's a small number. But, you know, again, you say I expect too much from people, but when you see people like Stephen Miller and Jim Jordan being absolutely unable to answer questions, they're just trying to obfuscate and trying to use the whole thing about the deep state conspiracy and stuff like that. It's so obvious that even Kevin McCarthy, who's the Senate, who's the House Minority Leader, looking absolutely ridiculous. You'd think you can tell that people are outright lying because it's right in front of your face.
You know what? I'm going to say what I've said almost every day since this impeachment thing began coming to a head. The thing I still don't understand, unless they're so petrified of a tweet from the president being critical of them, is why can't you say, I support most of the president's policies. I support him on X, Y, and Z. But I am deeply troubled by the conversation he had with the president of Ukraine.
Here's my prediction.
I am deeply troubled by his retweeting this Civil War tweet from
here's
this Jeffress guy.
That as soon as the people who have defended him smell blood on the water,
of course,
then they're going to do a 180. And I don't know whether that happens if things start look bad for the president as we go down weeks into this, or if polls start showing he's lost favor in those states where he has been very favorable. Then I think, I mean, there's no principle obviously involved there. So as soon as they think that they
self-preservation,
self-preservation, which is yet another reason why we need term limits.
877-301-8970. By the way, we have term limits in presidents and vice presidents. What's that getting us?
Well, I don't think we've ever had this kind of situation in a president before.
I think this is
new territory.
Mark in Boston, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling, Mark. Hi.
A long-time listener, second-time caller.
Thank you for both.
I want to say, in the interest of trying to pace my own rage, I'm going to focus on a very narrow issue.
Sure.
Tip of the hat to Julia Kayyem. Anyway, so I've seen a lot of the defenders of the president using legal terms. I'm a lawyer. I've been in practice for 25 years, mm-hmm. and they use essentially terms related to the criminal justice system, like right to confront your accusers, unreliability of hearsay, and like similar reference, you know, presumption of innocence. The presidency is a privilege and not a right. The rules of criminal practice and procedure do not apply to impeachment proceedings. The standard for indictment is enough House of Representatives members think it's deserved that they vote for it. The standard for conviction is enough U.S. senators believe it and vote for it. There's no particular burden of proof beyond, as was pointed out by young, incredible Lindsey Graham, you know, you don't even have to be accused of a crime, never mind convicted of it.
Do you remember, by the way, Mark, don't you remember, I think Gerald Ford was not president then, I think he was a member of Congress from Michigan, his line that I'm going to butcher a little bit, but the gist of it was when I asked, what's the criteria or criterion for impeachment? He says impeachment is whatever we say it is, which is essentially what you're saying. And he was right in the middle, right in the thick of things. There's also one other thing I'd add to your list, Mark, is the whistleblower thing is not like a nice idea. It's a statute. When Congress passed it and the president signed it into law, they knew that the person or people about whom the whistle was being blown would have an opportunity to confront the accusations, but would not have an opportunity to confront the accuser or the whistleblower. And obviously, Congress and a president were fine with that, correct?
There was a protection against corruption.
Exactly. Mark, sorry.
Well, that's one
we're
of
glad
things,
you made your second call. Thank you, Mark. Do a third soon.
One of the things we've all learned is that when they were writing that statute, it didn't seem to occur to anybody that the person that was accused could possibly be the president mm-hmm. of the United
Great
States.
Point.
And that's what caused this weird thing that McGuire now unfairly took heat for last week. And I'm guilty, too, because I thought, why in the world would you take this accusation to the two people who are being accused, the president and, of course, the Department of Justice, not realizing at the time that that's what you had to do. And we've learned this weekend that the CIA lawyer to whom the whistleblower just was making a regular complaint did the same thing that caused the whistleblower such concern. And that remember, they were stonewalling this. They weren't going to give over the transcript. They weren't going to give over the whistleblower complaint until Nancy Pelosi said we're starting an inquiry into impeachment. So Those are all things to keep in mind.
Well, another thing to keep in mind is an attorney general who actually cared about the law would have recused himself when the question about what this means and what's the obligation to transmit or not transmit to the intelligence committees came before the Justice Department, but even, because he might end up being a witness in any investigation. But obviously, to no one's surprise, he didn't recuse himself.
And because the attorney general sort of did an end run around the Justice Department, that made things a little bit more difficult for Bill Barr.
You know, we and others on the show have been very critical of Jeff Sessions, his predecessor. But you got to give it to Jeff Sessions on one thing. He apparently not only recused himself, but recused himself in a big-time sort of way in the Russia investigation, which is what ultimately led to his demise, because Trump never forgave him for having recused himself.
Who was the one that was talking about the 2016 election as the great white whale for the president? It's like he's Ahab and the great white whale. This Tom Bossert guy. He was a former Trump.
The Homeland Security guy.
Homeland Security guy. Yeah, who talked about that the president has an obsession with thinking that the Russians helped him win. He wouldn't have won without the Russians, and he just cannot let it go. And that has colored.
Because that undercuts the power of his win, he contends. Galen Acton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hi, first time caller, and ooh. I don't know how you do this. I am so nervous talking.
We're glad you called, Gail.
Thank you so much, both of you. I've been wondering if this isn't actually some kind of Republican or part of the Republican group who are tired of Trump and find this as a good opportunity to get the vice president on the ticket instead. I mean, they gave us that transcript. What? And I'm wondering if the Democrats are really playing into their hands. You know, we're going to go through this impeachment, which I think is an important thing to do, and we have to, right? But it's going to wreck our chances of getting elected, possibly, and then they'll get Pence on the ticket, and they'll get another Republican in office, and who the hell wants Trump anyway?
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. Do you know who apparently was, at least what I read this weekend, Gail, was the loudest voice urging the president not to release the transcript of the telephone? Well, it's not a transcript, a summary of the telephone call. It was Vice President Pence. No, Pence himself. I have to say, we've discussed, by the way, this is an excellent first call, Gail. There's no, doesn't sound like there are any nerves on your end of the phone. We've been asking for a long time, in light of the fact that Pence is a very, very conservative kind of guy who may have a lot of issues, but surely does not have the same corruption issues that this president does. Why aren't Republicans saying, hey, we're better off and we may be in better shape come election time? I don't know what the answer to that question is. What do you think the answer is, Marjorie? Why isn't Pence good enough and they'd be on the side of the angels in terms of fighting corruption in the presidency, and they end up with a rock-rib Republican
president?
Because I
don't think they think he would win.
Well, maybe that's the answer.
I mean, I don't think that – where has Pence impressed anybody? I mean, he might get a big white evangelical vote, but I don't think that's enough. I mean, let's be honest. Whether you like the president or don't like the president's a very compelling figure. He's very charismatic.
Maybe that's the answer,
Joe. He's great on television. I mean, has anybody been stirred to any great fervor by Mike Pence?
I guess that's your answer, Gail. Gail, thanks for your first call. We hope to hear from you again. 877-301-8970. But I guess I don't know how stirred they are or not stirred, but they are not tainted by the worst of Donald Trump. But
he's
I guess
tainted.
They don't worry. What do you mean he is?
Pence is.
By being there and being silent?
Yes.
I don't know if people – well, maybe you're right. You might be right on all that stuff.
I mean, his wife was mad at him reportedly, right?
That's one of the great lines.
Yeah, tell people
the,
that.
When he reaches – I'm going to get this – this is Michael Lewis, by the way.
Yes.
In The Fifth Risk, I think, who is this brilliant, brilliant writer who's done so many great things. It's his latest book. Something like they're in the – not situation room, in the – what do you call that room on election night? The whatever it is, the boiler room. They're in the boiler room, meaning they're sitting with all the key players. The results are coming in. And when it's clear that Trump has won the election, Mike Pence leans over to his wife to kiss her. And she says something like, Mike, you got what you wanted. Now get away from me. Apparently she was not and is not, at least from what. By the way, do you know there's a brand new, we have to get this author on. Just this weekend, Peter Baker from the New York Times wrote a review of this brand new book by, I can't think of the person's name, about Pence, about Pence. And I don't know if there's been one, at least not that I have seen. So I'm looking forward to it. Muhammad, you're in Providence. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, how we doing, folks?
Excellent.
Hi, thank you.
All right. Well, I just want to say that we were just talking about Mohammed bin Salman, the king of Saudi Arabia. And I have to say that Trump, for me, at least from somebody that comes from those asshole countries, and mainly I'm talking about the politics of those countries, he reminds me of a Mohammed bin Salman. His instincts are of Mohammed bin Salman, who is somebody that's a dictator and somebody that will go to any means to make sure that he protects his power at any cost. So facts for those individuals really don't matter, and they'll squash anybody that comes within that prism, so to speak. But I also want to say that the one thing is changing in this country is I think the Democrats are operating like it's 1982, and Ronald Reagan is in the White House, and we have to rely on the Constitution and all these other good folk Republican. And that's part of the issue with Biden. I believe he's going to lose the election because he's looking for those great Republicans to stand up. The time has changed. We have a cult-like mentality with the Republicans today. It's a tribal mentality. And I believe we're in a dangerous situation.
So, Mohammed, just so I'm clear, first of all, while I agree with part of your analogy up front, I think the one thing you can't accuse President Trump of doing with your comparison with the Crown Prince, he's not having journalists executed. He is putting them at great risk with this enemy of the people sickness that he keeps throwing. But what do you mean when you're comparing someone like Joe Biden to the Republican tactics? What should the Democrats be doing differently vis-a-vis Trump?
I believe, well, I have to kind of separate this too. I believe Joe Biden is also emblematic of most white Democrats because I believe for them the urgency is not so urgent. If you're black or African American, you've seen these type of individuals act in the ways they act, and you know they go to the extreme. But for a lot of white Democrats, they see these individuals that some of them are their family members. Some of them happen to be the grandfathers that have these Trump support type mentalities. Mm-hmm. So they believe these are good folks, so they're relatives of theirs. But on the other hand, some of us that come from these this background, whether you're a minority in this country, you know that these individuals mean business and they'll go at any length to get to fulfill their objectives. Biden comes from an era where he used to work with racists.
Oh, with Eastland and those people,
Yeah, he used to work with those individuals. But what was different then, I may argue, Jim, is the Constitution in America was always at the forefront. What has changed about Trump? Trump has pushed everything about America, it has made it great, to the brink. And he's willing to push it to the brink. And nothing in an environment that has tribal mentality will stop him, because at the end of the day, the tribe has to win. And that's what we're facing now. No leader in the Democratic Party, I believe, is ready for that type of action.
Mohammed, thank you very much for your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Yeah, well, that was a great point Mohammed made about not being ready for that, because many people are arguing that the Biden team is being naive and thinking that this constant naming of him and his son is not going to hurt him. I have no idea. I mean, we've many times said that Republicans are much tougher than Democrats.
Well, that's what Mohammed's point is. There's got to be more of a take-no-prisoners kind of approach, a la Donald Trump.
By the way, this is a quick aside. When he's talking about white Democrats, I was thinking of a black Democrat in the race, or at least a woman of color in the race, is Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Maya Rudolph.
Oh, my God, on Saturday Night Live. Oh, my God.
Imitation of Maya Rudolph, of Kamala Harris on Saturday Night Live. It was pretty funny if you haven't seen it.
Stephen Taunton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Listen, those in power want to stay in power. The only poll that matters is Trump's approval rating among Republicans. If that holds at 75, 80, 85, 90% as it is now, he'll survive. The senators won't dare go against them, and this will all have been another moot point.
Well, first of all, I think it's at 91%, the most recent amongst Republicans' support. You mean if they were to impeach him in the House and he's tried in the Senate, no Republican will abandon him because he's so strong with the base. Is that your point?
Absolutely. No question.
Well, yeah, I guess, one of the interesting things, I'm going to ask Catherine Clark this tonight, who obviously is a very high-ranking person in the Democratic infrastructure in the House, is it worth it if you don't remove the president from office? Is an impeachment process good for America, even if ultimately, as Steve suggests, the Republicans, you know, in the Senate protect him.
I think they had to do it. I mean, somebody was just talking about the Constitution. I mean, the Founding Fathers were obsessed with other foreign governments interfering in American politics. I mean, Thomas Jefferson talked about it. George Washington talked about it. He wasn't the founder, but he was the first president. And is he considered a founder, George Washington?
I don't know.
But he wasn't there in Philadelphia and stuff like that. John Adams, they were all obsessed with that. So I think you can't have this. I think the Democrats had to do this because it was such an egregious.
Or as you repeatedly said, they lost all moral authority. But
yeah.
The question is, if they are candid, and I don't know how candid they are or can be, meaning the Democratic leadership, if they really believe that even if public opinion moves a smidge, that ultimately, as Steve from Taunton said, as long as Trump's numbers with the Republicans remain incredibly high, that the Republicans in the Senate would never vote to convict him, was the whole exercise worth it?
Yes,
anyway,
yes, I think it's absolutely
because you
worth
think
it.
They were
because I think you had to do it or you
to attempt
you've
to
lost
hold them accountable.
Authority. But the other thing is, it's not the Republicans that are going to decide this race. It's that's different. Impeachment, yes, but it's independents that are going to matter. And here's why I'm hopeful. Because I understand completely why you would vote for Trump the first time
around. In the presidential election, they matter. What Steve's point was
yes.
In Senate races,
Republican
senators care more about their Republican base than they do independents. You're running for president. Independents, I agree with
right.
you, are going to be critical.
Well, that's why I'm hopeful guardedly about 2020, but who knows? Amy in Cambridge. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Amy.
Oh, hi. I want to say, first of all, Marjorie, I completely agree with you that the Democrats absolutely had to do this because ultimately, if they don't do this, then the Constitution and democracy are pretty much finished. And I have kids who are just going to be coming out of college, and I think, you know, well, why should they stay here? They don't have a voice. They're studying government. Why should they stay here?
So you stay in the United States, you mean?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly not the only one around here thinking about this, whether our kids should stay here, whether we should stay here, because the Constitution could be finished if the Democrats didn't confront it now. And in that respect, I don't think it really, I don't know what, none of us know what will happen in the Senate. We don't know how the impeachment inquiry may or may not move the needle among Republicans. I do agree that it's likely to move it among independents. That was my first point. My second point was, this is my nightmare scenario in the Senate, and that is that McConnell allows a vote to be taken. He's talked to Pence. He said, you're going to be president, and you're not going to be president in 2020 because you'll never win the election, and so get ready to step aside, and the RNC taps Nikki Haley to run, and that makes me very nervous. That's my big fear.
Former governor of South Carolina and former
appointee
of this president.
Yeah. She's a very talented politician, and she separated herself early on from this presidency.
And she's very ambitious.
Yeah.
Well, so are they all. But Amy, that's an interesting scenario, which I don't think is as absurd as some people may think.
No, I think Nikki.
Anything is far fetched.
She's much
and
more.
And Mitch McConnell runs the show.
Yeah, she's much more electrifying than Pence.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. I mean, in my mind, the only thing that McConnell is thinking about is who's going to be president in 2020 and how do I manage this right now. I think that's the only thing on his mind, in my opinion. Anyway, thanks,
Amy. Thank you. Yeah, we appreciate your phone call. What are you looking at there?
I was looking at an email briefly, Jim.
We have time for one more. No, it's okay. We have time for another one.
Mike in Worcester. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike.
Hi. How you doing?
Great.
I think you are overstepping the credulity or you're not taking seriously the idea that Pence could be as bad as Trump. He stands as close to him, and therefore just by that closeness, that proximity, he's got to be knowledgeable about what's going on. And how could anyone want to consider him as a president?
Well, by the way, when you say could be as bad, you mean because he may be part of this whole set of acts on the part of the president. A lot of people think he's worse because, unlike most of us, I am among those who think that Donald Trump really doesn't have an ideology and he doesn't really believe in some of the things that he's advancing that have gotten him that 91% support amongst Republicans. But Mike Pence is a total true believer. And
I think regardless of what he believes, how can he stand in support of a guy who's lied how many thousands of times, who has no understanding of what the need for immigration?
Mike, how can there not be one person in the whole Trump administration, not one, who is willing to resign and stand up and hold a press conference and say, I am resigning because I can't continue to serve an administration that is doing what he's doing to the country?
Pressure on, and I think we need to continue this. We got to work step by step to investigate and win the little battles leading up to the impeachment.
Mike, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
You know, that is a great question.
What's
up? I do wonder why people like Dan Coats, who is the former head of intelligence,
who has nothing to lose. He's probably 70-something years old. He's not looking for another job.
McMaster, who left early on.
Well, they make oblique references here and there
you'd think that those people that have devoted their lives to the service of the United States of America wouldn't get up and...
How about Mitt Romney? He doesn't have an election in 5 years. Instead of gaining praise for being troubled by what's going on, why... This is the guy who said the election of Donald Trump would be the worst thing in the history of this country.
He said he was a total fraud.
Then he wanted to
man.
Be Secretary of
remember?
State.
Remember?
I do remember it very
speech?
Well. Why there are a lot of people well-positioned who don't have to worry about what Donald Trump can do to them, and why are they not? Why is not one of them, if they believe that he's so horrible, not sounding the alarm? And it's got to be a whistleblower. Remember, it was an anonymous op-ed writer. Was it in the Washington Post year or so ago? And a whistleblower who's just hoping that he or she has whistleblower law protection. I mean, it is.
Well, you know who stood up there and done it right out in front in public?
Who's that?
Four women.
Well, that's a good point. But they're not Trump loyalists. It's one thing. Your credibility is much greater when you've been inside.
You know what's to go out.
I agree with it. I agree.
Them.
They've been great.
And they have been harassed and in need of security.
I agree.
In many instances since they had the courage to do that. Coming up, Bob Thompson joins us to recap the finale of Transparent. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. After the groundbreaking series Transparent was renewed for a fifth season, it found itself in an awkward situation, having to drop its star actor. Jeffrey Tambor, who played the lead character, patriarch-turned-matriarch, Maura Pfefferman, was fired amidst sexual harassment accusations. So, show creator Jill Soloway's script fix was to kill off Pfefferman and compress an entire fifth and final season into a 100-minute musical.
We need... A joy, a cost for all the lives we've lost. This pain in all of us remains at quite a cost. 6 million ain't no joke. We win for losing folk. Need a celebration of the soul for this extermination Super Bowl.
Joining us on the line to talk about this, the new Netflix series, The Politician, and other TV news is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello, Bob Thompson.
Hello. Boy, what a clip to start with.
Yeah, well, I read a New York Times review of the feature-length Transparent musical finale that's on Amazon. It wasn't exactly a rave review. What do you think?
Yeah, and by the way, musicale finale.
Musicale. Excuse me.
We should call it. I've now watched this twice, and of course, this was a very important show. This was came out, you know, we had Orange is the New Black, the cover of Time magazine, Caitlyn Jenner, Transparent. I mean, a lot of stuff was going on. This was a groundbreaking show, and then, of course, there were the Jeffrey Tambor accusations, which we should say he still denies. And it's been, what, I think almost 2 years exactly that we saw the last season of this. And now they did it all with this musical. It was fascinating in so many ways. I mean, you've got bizarre, I mean, a song called The Joyocoste, which is, you know, defined as an equal and opposite reaction to the Holocaust. That takes some time to wrap one's head around. Maura's wife also is putting on a play about her husband. Essentially, she's making the show, but recasting him with a trans person as opposed to Jeffrey Tambor, who was not. What else is in there? For someone who doesn't identify as male or female, they have bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah get combined into bart mitzvah. There's a camp for young girls who are on the onset of their menses. No, I'm not kidding. That's really in the show. They jam this all into 100 minutes. There's a cremation. There's all kinds of stuff. It is filled with trans identity, Jewish identity. It's a fascinating 100 minutes of television, let's just put it that way.
By the way, can you, as a TV historian, amongst your other hats, can you ever remember a time when we had, what, House of Cards had to do something because of Kevin Spacey, and then Roseanne disappeared, and now Jeffrey Tambor? I mean, that's three leads in three pretty important series almost on top of each other.
Yeah, I mean, in television history, that used to happen because either the lead died or the lead got into a contract, negotiation issue. But part of that was the fact that I don't think that means that people weren't getting away with stuff, or partly
very good
not
point
the fact
that they
that
were getting away.
That, that yeah. They were getting away. Right.
That's a very good point.
They weren't getting fired for that. They were getting fired for, other kinds of things that we were talking about back then. But no, we've had a number of those, situations, and many of them in really important shows. I mean, Transparent and The Cosby Show, two very, very, very significant shows for very, very, very good reasons, significant. And in both cases, we've had, these major controversial issues surrounding their stars.
You know, speaking of Bill Cosby very briefly, I just remember I read a piece last week that last week was the one-year anniversary of his time in jail. You know what I didn't realize? He got 3 to 10. And while most of us thought because of his age he'd never get out alive, I have no idea what the rule. It's Pennsylvania, right? Is that where he's in prison?
I don't remember.
It's not inconceivable that Cosby could live through a shortened term if he gets out on good behavior. In any case, we'll check into that. So what's your best of the week, Bob Thompson?
Well, I'm doing my best worst in what to watch, all based on network broadcast television shows, because, of course, this past week was the opening week of the fall season. Mm-hmm. And I know that sounds quaint, and I know it sounds colonial Williamsburg, but it's still meaningful. Network TV still generates some of the most profitable stuff that will ultimately end up on streaming. We've talked about that before. We're still to sign, and there were 13 new shows debuted over the last week. I'm giving my best reluctantly to a show I was not expecting to like by a guy I was not expecting to like the show who made the show, and that's this Bob Hartz Abishola on CBS. Now, a little bit of background. This comes from Chuck Lorre, who everybody is expecting and CBS is especially hoping for, is going to redo the success he did on The Big Bang Theory, which is one of the most profitable shows in the history of television. Chuck Lorre created the reprehensible 2 and a Half Men. He created the relatively mild Big Bang Theory, and he created the really good Kominsky Method, his first show for Netflix. This is a show about a guy in Detroit who owns a compression sock factory. And one of the reasons it gets my best is I think
that's where we're all headed.
There's been other shows.
Go ahead.
There's been other shows set in Detroit in the history of television, so that's not new. But I think, and a caller can correct me if I'm wrong, I think this is the first time in the history of American television since it was introduced in the World's Fair in 1939 in Queens, New York. I think this is the first time there's ever been a show whose main character owns a compression sock factory.
I've been waiting for that, though. I've been saying to Marjorie for years that that was a huge hole.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I'm like a little compression
anyway,
sock humor.
And all those, you know, jokes that have never been told about socks.
Exactly.
Now there's a place for that to for that to happen. Anyway, so he has a heart attack and he falls in love with his nurse, and she's from Nigeria, and her family's from Nigeria, and she lives there, and they're going to follow this whole story about him and her immigrant family. And some of the critics have been complaining about its stereotypes, and I think they make a point. On the other hand, Chuck Lorre had the wisdom to hire a comedian named Gina Yashere, who was born in London, but she was born from parents from Nigeria, who's been doing comedy for some time about these things. And she co-created the show with him and has written at least the first three episodes. And I don't think this show is going to last as long as The Big Bang Theory did, but it's got I found it actually quite charming.
Oh. Well, The Big Bang Theory shouldn't have lasted as long as The Big Bang Theory did. Here's a little piece from the pilot episode.
What's your name?
Abishola.
You can call me Bob.
Good nighty, Bob. What now?
I never liked the sound of my name, but when you say it, it sounds nice. Bob. Say it again.
Good nighty, Bob.
Oh, yeah. It's way better than Bob.
I'm looking for a nurse. Her name is Abishol. I wanted to thank her.
She's not on right now.
Do you have her address?
Oh, I can't give that out.
May I help you? Yes, I'm looking for Abishol.
What do you want with Abishola? There's something wrong.
Why does there have to be something wrong?
There's a white man at the door. Tell me, when has that ever been good?
So, Bob, let's move on to what's your worst of the week, Bob?
Okay, if I was expecting to not like Bob Hart's Abishola, and I did kind of like it, I was expecting to like Prodigal Son, which also debuted, it was on Fox, same day, on Monday, because it had Michael Sheen, who I find to be a very talented person who has done some really wonderful work. And I didn't like it. It was just, it was kind of like, if you took the idea behind Dexter and just made it really badly, that you would end up with Prodigal Son. In this case, the father is the serial killer teaching the son to solve crimes, as opposed to vice versa.
Oh, nice.
But it was just one of these, and there's so many of these procedurals that debuted this past week. All Rise, Bluff City Law, Prodigal Son, one right after another. And I guess these shows tend to do well. Prodigal Son's ratings were not terrible, but I just found it really uninteresting. And I found Michael Sheen's performance in it almost enough to make me think forget all the great things he's done before.
Well, you left out one key part of the narrative from the show. Is the reason the guy became a serial killer, his compression socks were too tight. Did you? I mean, who can blame him? Those really hurt. When here's a little. You have a clip from that, Marjorie?
That would be a good tie-in episode. Unfortunately, they're on two different networks.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, here's a clip from the pilot, Prodigal Son. Malcolm Bright is a criminal profiler for the FBI on the scene of a homicide when he gets a call from dear old dad.
This is ridiculous.
A notorious serial killer known, isn't this swell, as the Surgeon, and he's played by Michael Sheen.
Malcolm, my boy, it's Dad.
What?
How the hell do you have a phone?
Oh, I don't. I have phone time. A critical distinction.
So tell me about the body.
Every killer leaves their own unique signature. Now, I want to hear all the details. I want to really be able to see it in my head. I don't need your help. Oh, don't be a killjoy. I have so much to offer. And we're both obsessed with murder, like father, like son.
Yeah, I knew Hannibal Lecter. I went to school with Hannibal Lecter. He is no Hannibal Lecter. That's a killjoy. I mean, that sounds so horrible.
He sounds a little cheerful for a serial killer in jail,
doesn't
he?
Well, they're supposed to be odd.
And he also does, if you look at how they've got him made up and his hair and the rest of it, he looks like if Saturday Night Live did a Charlie Manson parody. That's what he's playing. He's doing a he's got that whole Manson eye thing going and all the rest of it. Anyway, I don't think this is going to last very long, but it's I don't know why his agent ever let him do it.
So I know with What to Watch, you said we're going to get back to network television, but Netflix is the politician. One of the producers is the brother of an occasional guest on our show who ran for governor.
That's right.
Evan Falchuk joins us from time to time, and Brad Falchuk is one of the troika of big-time producers of this thing, right?
Is he married to Gwyneth?
He is, yep.
Right, who's in the show, by
I heard that,
And Ryan Murphy, of course, is the other of the triad of people who produce this. And they brought us Nip Tuck, Glee, American Horror Story, American Crime Story, Feud, Pose. I mean, these are not insignificant shows in the history of television. And this is a really it just debuted on Netflix on Friday, so they're all out. And it's a very creepy, odd. It's got some elements of Glee. There's songs in it and the rest of it, but it's about a high school kid running for president of the student body. But the campaign is being run like it was for the president of the United States. You got to choose a running mate. There's all of this scandal. I mean, it's a weird combination of what we're seeing on CNN or what we saw on CNN a couple of years ago and a high school, a high school show. And it's oddly appealing in all kinds of disturbing ways.
So can we go from HBO to Succession? From Netflix to HBO. As soon as I'm finished The Wire, I have about another week's worth of watching. This is number one on my list. I hope you like this. Do you? I've heard great, great things about it.
I do, and this is under our category of In Case You Missed It,
okay.
Or better yet, the category of In Case I Missed It,
okay.
Because I came to this relatively late. It got one important Emmy last Sunday, and it's one of those shows kind of like Breaking Bad, like Fleabag, that it starts out and then more and more people discover it and they get more excited. And now it's like the thing. It's the show everybody's talking about. It's kind of a combination of King Lear, Dallas, and Rupert Murdoch all rolled into one. And I wouldn't say it's one of the most brilliant shows ever done on television, but it is a delicious, lathery soap opera about, as the title suggests, succession. This guy has this huge media operation, not unlike Rupert Murdoch, and he decides to retire, then not retire, and all the stuff that happens afterwards. I finally got through the whole thing in a binge because, as I said, I came late to it, and it was really fun.
Here's a clip from season two featuring the character of Greg musing about his first time on a private plane.
I can't believe I'm on a private plane. It's like I'm in a band. Very white, very wealthy band. It's like I'm in U2.
Welcome to the inner sanctum.
Yeah, it's nice. Way nicer than the outer sanctum.
So why is it that certain shows that turn out to be quite good and quite popular sort of in hibernation or under the radar for a whole year? I mean, it took me a long, I don't know if you said this a minute, it took me a long time to finally discover Breaking Bad, and then obviously I feel about it like you do. Why do shows like this have those kinds of experiences?
Well, because there's so many shows out there. And they're debuting on so many different places, five different networks and cable channels and streaming and all the rest of it. And it's nobody can keep up. So the really good stuff eventually rises to the top of the cultural conversation. You were not alone with Breaking Bad. Most people discovered that show watching it on Netflix, not watching it when it originally aired on its cable channel. Fleabag, which the Emmys, were drooling over this past week, they ignored for its first season. So it does take a while, and I guess it's one of the blessings of this new media distribution environment that shows, in fact, can survive long enough for us to kind of eventually come to them. It used to be that if it was not love at first sight with a television show, it got canceled and that was the end of it. Now there's the opportunity for a relationship to develop over time. And it's allowed, I think, a lot of interesting shows to exist in a way that they could not possibly have existed in the old order.
Well, we know this is fiction, and supposedly it's loosely based on the Murdochs and the Redstones, you know, the media empire.
Oh, I didn't know that, actually.
Well, that's
what
I've read, right? It's kind of a combination of both of them. But what's interesting to me is that there is a real-life battle between the sons of Rupert Murdoch, Lachlan and James.
Right.
And James is much more liberal, and Lachlan is much more of a libertarian. But neither of them is particularly thrilled with Donald Trump. And there's been a lot written this weekend about unrest at Fox News and how much the president's survival in this mess is determined by the angle that Fox News takes on this.
That's right.
So it's a very interesting thing to talk about, because Rupert must be, gosh, in his mid to late 80s by now, right?
So it would be. I think it'd be really fun, if you haven't started Succession yet, to watch The Loudest Voice,
that show
we talked about before, which was about Murdoch, and then watch Succession as kind of a fictional burlesque on that. But the two of them together, actually, there's one theme humming in the background of both of them.
He's 88, by the way. Just
88. He's not probably quite as fast on the fastball as he used to be, and it's going to be really interesting to see which of the sons prevails.
Yeah, at 88, if he was an American, he could run for president. Why not? Okay, so what are we watching?
Lear's 94, and he's still producing TV shows.
It is amazing. Boy, it gives us all hope. What are we watching this week, Bob Thompson?
All right. I'm going back to the fact that we're in the broadcast premiere week. October 6th on ABC. ABC, of course, is getting great success by remaking these old kind of game shows and that kind of thing. Tiffany Haddish is going to be the host of a new version of Kids Say the Darndest Things. Now, if you're under the age of about 60, you may have no idea what that was. But Art Linkletter used to talk to little kids on radio back in 1945, I think he started doing it. And he did it on TV well into the 1967 or so. And it's just this, kind of thing where you talk to kids and kids say funny things and all of that. And then it was remade in the 1990s, hosted by none other than...
Oh, Bill Cosby, right?
Bill Cosby.
Right,
exactly.
I had forgotten about that. Yeah.
So I am a very, very big admirer of Tiffany Haddish. I think she's going to be really good at this, and she may be able to reclaim this franchise that Art Linkletter started when the Second World War was still going and that Bill Cosby picked up at the turn of the century.
I'm very looking forward to this.
Why is that, Marjorie?
Because, I mean, it's a little relief.
Because kids do say the darndest things.
Kids are pretty damn funny, and it's funny to watch them
talking. It's not going to get any Peabody's. It's not going to, but, every now and then, I think some of that stuff is funny. You know who is the best at talking to kids, though? Jimmy Kimmel. He every now and again does a segment where he'll bring kids in, and he is absolutely hilariously able to deal with kids and say do those interviews. He'd also be really good at this.
By the way, you know who wouldn't be really good at it, Marjorie? Me. About a year ago, I had this kid on who was in the Boston Globe who announced that she was going to run for president. And part of the Globe story said this woman can, this young girl, I think she was like 8, can talk a blue streak. So I had her on my show with her mother. She would not say one word. I don't mean like short sentences. I mean, she was so petrified.
Oh,
not
gosh.
One word. So they won't be having me on anytime
okay.
soon.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to it anyway. Bob Thompson, thank
Great
you
to
very
talk
much.
To you, Bob.
Thank you, guys.
Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Up next, time for All Revved Up with Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They're next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day. Our Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price III. They join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, Boston's voice for Detour's African American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett's professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. They're also the hosts of the All Revved Up podcast. To learn more about that and to subscribe, you go to allrevvedup.org. Irene, Emmett, good to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
And glad to be here.
So this is a strange story, and I'm dying to talk to you both about this. Harvard President Larry Bacow apologized Saturday for comments he made comparing the 13th Amendment, which of course freed slaves, to the university's relationship with wealthy donors. And he tried to explain that, you know, the 13th Amendment, as I said, abolished the ownership of people. Likewise, Bacow said, Harvard's individual schools couldn't own their wealthy alumni. I don't know. Okay, we'll go to Irene.
I don't even know what she's going to say, and I'm totally with you. Let me tell you, this is unbelievable. Go ahead.
No, you know, it's really a shame here. This is a gentleman who's president of the university.
He is.
Okay, and Harvard is doing a lot of work to sort of correct its relationship to American slavocracy here. And so you would think that this gentleman would even trying to use the metaphor, the image of enslavement, that he wouldn't juxtapose wealthy donors to being shackled, you know, to the whole notion of the 13th Amendment. This is a guy that really, he should have said, he did say he's sorry, but he really displayed historical ignorance. And this is something that you don't expect from such a premier institution.
Kind of, it's almost like one of those things in polite society. We don't make weird remarks about slavery. We don't make real remarks about the Holocaust. Or just certain things, you don't go there.
I mean, as president.
For this president, assigned viewing is Ava DuVernay's phenomenal documentary,
oh gosh.
13 yeah.
Right? I mean, it was beyond a slip. It was beyond tone deaf. I mean, this is the kind of thing that really gets in my craw, because Harvard University's endowment is so large because it was first, but also because of folks who had put life insurance policies on slaves so that when they died, they cashed in and became benefactors of this. So not only the tone deaf, it's like totally revisionist history in that sense.
But I want to stay on this for a minute, but I want to explain it a little bit more. You explained it well, but I was really confused when I first heard the story this weekend. The notion about this ownership thing, as Marjorie said, 13th Amendment banned the ownership of African Americans. And when Marjorie was mentioning Harvard's individual schools could no longer own their specific wealthy graduates, what it meant is if you're a wealthy person who graduated from law school, and you're the development office at law school, you can't own John Doe.
Right. That's right.
And meaning he has to be encouraged to donate to other schools, maybe
That's
the School
right.
of
Bill
Public
Gates
Health
is a good
at
example.
Harvard, that,
yeah.
whatever it is.
Yeah.
So I have to say, this is, and I am totally where Marjorie is, I'm willing to make a comparison about anything. I don't think I've ever made a comparison with anything to slavery nor anything to the Holocaust.
Right. Yeah.
And I've never met Bacow. I've heard every single person who has a close relationship with him actually has told me wonderful things mm-hmm. about him. They say he's smart. He's thoughtful. This is grotesque.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
if he was talking about someone suffering, I would say I still would, you know, don't go to slavery thing. He's talking about zillionaire donors.
Yeah.
And he's
yeah.
just saying
free
hey,
labor, juxtaposed
all of you
to
people,
free labor. Yeah.
Don't think this is like a 13th Amendment
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I think what it really shows here, and Marjorie, you've been very open about in terms of that you took American history and you're always shocked by the kind of stuff.
Constantly.
Yeah, but the point is that you did, and you did it at one of the top schools. You went to Stanford. And I think what it really highlights is that really, you can go to the best schools. You can be, quote unquote, deemed or lauded as one of the most, you know, intelligent people. But when it really comes to understanding American history, it is bereft of understanding marginalized people. He's a classic example. Listen, I don't think that he's a bad man. I don't think he's a racist. I think he's like most white Americans. Don't have an understanding of other disenfranchised people.
Did you hear the call from Muhammad from Providence earlier in the show today? We were talking about politics. And if you just tuned in, Muhammad said, totally respectfully, essentially, I'm paraphrasing since you all heard it, mm-hmm. if I got it wrong or got it off a little bit, white people don't get what the rules of the game in politics are. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about, you know, and I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think what he was saying is, you know, you can theorize intellectually about what life is like under a Trump mm-hmm. regime mm-hmm. for disenfranchised people and people of color. For those of us who are disenfranchised and people of color, it's a whole different kettle of fish. But, you know, the other thing, is that a fair description
oh,
of
yeah.
what Muhammad
yeah,
is saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so
yeah.
the other thing that's really troubling to me about this, and I understand power dynamics and all this sort of stuff, to say something this egregious and for nobody in the room to feel they had the right, for lack of a better expression,
right.
not to voice to a friend or a reporter 2 days later
right.
that it was a little troubling. But excuse me, President Bacow, I know
right.
you didn't mean that, even if he did.
Or, right.
It really is offensive.
Or on his development staff.
Yeah.
I mean, usually when you get out and make a big speech in that kind of crowd, you've been vetted.
People, yeah.
It's been scripted. You've gone through it. And so for someone not to say that, I love what Muhammad said because it reminds me of what Irene says about politics, about the movable middle
yeah.
In terms of people. But there's a movable consciousness. And in the political realm that we're in, the movable consciousness is moving away from empathy. It's moving away from sensitivity of personhood. And it's moving away from individuals. It's moving towards platforms and positions.
But this is what I think. So it's wonderful to talk about a movable consciousness, but what we don't understand that it have to move if indeed there's a way to spark some kind of infuse some sort of information to help it move. I think, but I think this is the issue. Because at one point I said, well, this is not Donald Trump. He's not going off script. I thought this, that King had said it best. He said it really isn't the vitriolic statements of the bad white people. It's the appalling silence of white folks. And some of that is what I call a white folks politic of silence, that they become culpability and they collude in the very thing that many with good intentions want very much to eradicate. And so I really agree that someone should have said very quickly that, oh, and he could have easily backtracked, oh, I made a mistake. It's nothing. Actually, it would have been wonderful to have done that. Oh, I made a mistake. This is what I really meant.
Right. I can't believe I said that. But,
yeah,
you know, by the way,
you know.
And the reason it's I don't mean to belabor this, but let's for a minute is this. I was just looking up the date long before Bacow got there. And there are a million of these. There was the thing. Remember the black law professors, the photographs,
oh my
yep.
God,
their photographs
yeah.
had black tape put over them.
Right.
I don't think it was ever found out who was responsible for that, if I remember correctly. Just recently, and I don't know if it was before or after this, an unnamed faculty member, a woman, had apparently a disgusting note put on her door in the last few days, questioning her why she's at Harvard based upon her ethnicity and immigration status. And again, in all fairness, to back out, this may have been after. I don't know what the timing was. But the point is, it isn't like it's an institution where there had not been major concerns problems, about race. Yeah. A lot of the kids of color who are freshmen have talked about how
Am I Harvard?
Right. That's exactly that hashtag. Am I Harvard? Yeah. And I'm almost speechless
but
about
But I'm not, though, because, you know, even people that I admire, I'm going to give you one person I admire, Meryl Streep. I love her. I really do here.
It's overrated, Donald Trump said.
I know. But so she was in this film. It was a British film about suffragists here. And in promoting the film, they had these T-shirts that says that I'd rather be a rebel than a slave. As if, okay, and so the suffragist movement here certainly hits the years of American slaveocracy up until, you know, 1920, where we will next year be celebrating its 100th anniversary. Mm-hmm. As if, one thing, that someone would want to be a slave. That was a choice. But what it really highlight is the lack of coalition building. And it really showed that when you bring out black people to help your cause, it really is for a photo op moment. Because do you think, really, Harriet Tubman or Sojourner Truth wanted to be a slave? You know,
well, the one thing we did learn in history is there was a tremendous amount of racism in the suffragette.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is but it's in anything. It's very much entrenched in Harvard, and to really purge it, it has to do a kind of curriculum that makes certain things like mandatory, or in a way that people understand how Harvard and Brown up south, because they always think that it's all took place down south, but how up south financed this commerce machine.
Can I say one more thing about this?
Yeah,
I'm
really
sorry. I don't know why this has put me over the edge like this.
I think
this.
Big. Can we get to Law and Order SVU?
We will.
My favorite subject.
Or as you call it, Law and Order SUV. One last thing here.
We've got to talk about
I haven't read the actual email, and I should have, and I'm irresponsible for not having done a Backhouse apology email. But here's the part what's quoted in the Globe. I regret that these comments caused offense. Is that what you...
No.
Regret?
No, that's one of those backhanded. Yeah, that's
no apology. That's apology.
Right,
no
I regret
apology.
That was so stupid to have said this.
But now he's following the script. That's the script.
I don't think that's the script. I think that that's who he is, because you can get with something as egregious.
I hope that's
as
how
that,
he is, because again, I've heard great stuff about him.
You could say I really made. See, but I don't think it takes away from him. I think it really just shows you how pervasive racism is.
Maybe
and stuff.
Maybe
but
you're
no.
Right.
But the arrogance is this, because he didn't have to be scripted on this, because you can just say, "Oh my God."
This was in response to a question, by the way. And this is not in defense of his. I don't think this is part of his presentation. I think it's part. But it is, again, it popped into his head that he should cite the 13th Amendment.
Listen, this is what I want. If you want to make amendments here, okay, as one who went to Harvard, you can just, listen, give me back all my tuition money. Or better yet, just give me my reparations. I'll be happy. Okay,
Marjorie, take it away.
Well, this got me very upset, because this
me
is a
too.
Very compelling essay in the Boston Globe by Angela Unwatchy Willig, I hope I got that right. She makes a great point that by watching Law and Order SVU, which I have watched for more hours,
and we love all of, we love it.
I love it. I've watched it like once 5 hours in a row with my daughter. It was a
Olivia
disgrace.
Benson. We love Olivia.
We love Olivia. We love Olivia. But she does make a good point that it's rationalizing racial bias in the sense that we're watching the cops cut corners, we're watching the cops do things they shouldn't, we're watching the criminal justice system in a bad light, and we shouldn't be watching it.
I disagree.
I'm sorry.
I disagree.
Oh, good.
I love to watch it. I have to tell you.
On a snowy day,
so I love
wintertime.
It. And unfortunately, I have to tell you something. I watch reruns of it.
Me too.
Okay? So I tell you why I disagree.
It's all about gruesome murders, mostly
yes,
of children and sex crimes.
So let me tell you why I particularly like SUV. So that's the sexual violence unit.
That's one, yep.
And it really
SVU, not SUV.
Oh,
Marjorie,
okay,
Marjorie and you doing the same.
Special Victims Unit.
Thank you. All right. Oh, that's right. It's not an SUV.
I called it SUV,
okay,
too.
Thank you, Mark. Okay. But the reason why I like the SVU segment in particular, not only because I like Olivia Benson.
Love her.
Okay, I love her too here. I think that it does a couple of things here. It educates a population about various forms of sexual molestation, violence, and rape. Date rape being one of them. I think that it helps you to understand that you can be inebriated to the point that you are just out of your righteous mind. But no male or female has the right to violate you because you have not given consent. I think that it gives you language to describe without feeling shame, you know, feeling guilty. I think that it's helped push the Me Too movement. I think that it sets an ideal notion of how certain things can be executed and the right that you have as a citizen. So I felt like SUV not only taught me more about the law, corrupt and good, okay? It taught me how to be a better criminal.
It has taught me that too.
Yep. It gives me language that I would not know that has become part of everyday, you know, parlance.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah, I disagree.
Emmett, you're gonna
with the premise.
I am.
You're going to blow us out of
water. I am, but I'm going to let Irene finish.
No, I just, that was it.
I think
here.
I'm with Emmett on this one. Go ahead, okay. Emmett.
I mean, first of all, this was a phenomenal piece by the new dean of the law school at Boston University, a black
woman.
Oh,
I didn't know.
So she's both a sociologist and critical race theorist, and mm-hmm. I mean, just bringing a whole new perspective to all of us. I think that these shows, and I used to watch it, and I'm guilty, you know, up until however many years ago, I probably quote all the scripts from all of the, you know, Law and Orders, until I began to see myself in a way that I didn't want to see myself reflected in these shows. The black and the brown guys are always the criminals, always the rapists, always, you know, and it desensitizes us to the notion that these are horrific crimes. I mean, the show starts out with a da-dum, and then you see what happens, right? And then it's like, okay, I can't wait to see if they figure it out or not. What are you talking about? That's somebody's life. That's a person laying dead there, or
well,
somebody been violated
all
or traumatized.
The segments,
then. There's a lot of white bad guys.
Yeah, no, but wait, can I get in here for a second,
okay,
please?
You haven't even watched it.
No, you can't have it.
You can't get in here. You've not watched it.
No, because I've been rereading the Mueller report. I haven't had time.
Oh, okay. But he has not seen all the episodes.
It doesn't matter.
Wait, because I have to say this. Because there are a number of black cops. There's this brother that looked like Marvin Gaye. I can't think of his name.
Yeah.
He's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Okay. I disagree with that.
Desensitizing.
Okay. I'm going to use you. I don't need to see it.
Ice-T was great.
By the way, I have seen the SUV version of it. I have not seen the SVU version.
Oh,
no, I'm going to use your argument against you.
Oh, okay.
You were arguing that some of the that there's a lot in the show that creates important information and public education for viewers. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say there's a piece of the show that makes an impression on the viewing public, which is an important one, and then say when they see the cop. By the way, I know listeners are sick of me saying this. I've been watching The Wire nonstop for the last couple
of
months.
Yeah.
Maybe the best show ever in television.
Yeah,
and when I read this woman's piece this morning, I'm saying to myself, I cheer when the cops break all the rules to get the really bad guys. And if I was 12 years old cheering the cops, breaking all the rules to get the real. So the good news is I get the good lessons that Irene Monroe is saying I should take away from this about respecting women and those sort of things. But the bad news is I'm also taking away these horrible lessons about the means justify the ends when it comes to the bad guys.
No, it really. So I think it depends on the person. I think it's where you are, because I just felt like, and maybe I'm just jaded. I know that the cops.
You are.
I know that the cops will, you know, don't follow the law. I mean, any person of color living here would understands that here. So in terms of rationalizing racial bias, no, not at all. It just shows how we have normalized it.
But a kid may not be at your level of development and understanding.
No, I understand that.
Well, a kid shouldn't be watching.
Well, that's
SVU.
My point.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You told your kid watch, and so did mine.
What are you talking about?
When they were little.
You shouldn't be watching. No.
I think
because
she was
they
at least
say
17.
Parental. See, you don't watch it because if you did, it says parental. Come on, work with me.
Discretion advised.
Because
which is always an invitation for young people to watch.
Exactly.
I mean, come on. You know what we haven't said? Okay. That Law and Order SVU ripped from the headlines. Don't they always say that? Stories are ripped from the headlines. They do real stories in the New York Post.
They really do. Absolutely. They depict real life situations.
I mean, Irene,
and I never agree with you, but it's great.
It's a Sunday afternoon.
That's right.
You don't want to go to shopping. You just sit there and watch 4 hours of Law and Order SVU.
And be greatly educated.
I'm ashamed of you, Irene.
Exactly. Two people of principle and two SVU viewers in this room.
You get the crime right at the beginning.
That's right.
Then the commercial, then the suspect, then the commercial. It's all resolved by the end.
Yeah, right. And it's better than Columbo because you can always figure it out like 2 minutes into the show. Or Perry. Listen, I'm dating myself.
Perry Mason.
By the way, when you watch Columbo, weren't you always wondering if he was wearing anything under that raincoat? That was my.
You're perverted.
Okay, before we leave this,
you're perverse.
Can I say something? Since this is Pope Watch, before you go, and what's the Pope's problem with adjectives?
You know, I think this is a little bit splitting hairs. What is this? He doesn't want people to be called authentically Christian, just Christian. He doesn't want churches called small but authentic. He just wants them to say that they're Catholic or they're Christian.
Because the implication is they're maybe inauthentic? Is that...
I guess this is what I think.
I think that he likes for folks to speak in declarative statements. He wants you to cut the fat and flourishes in a statement.
Right.
So I wouldn't say that Emmett is a very good guy. I just say he's a good guy.
He's a guy.
Okay, he's our guy, absolutely. So I want to help him with his economy of expression using declarative statements. Mm-hmm. So this is what I give the Pope in helping him in his sentence structure. Instead of saying that the Catholic Church will work to stop child abuse, okay, because that's a conditional statement because of will. He will say the church has stopped child abuse by having its pedophilic priests incarcerated and once out placed on sex registries throughout the country.
And
there
they've lobbied for an end to statute of limitations on all criminal violations.
Declarative, strong statements.
I was thinking the other day, Marjorie and I were lucky enough to participate in the 50th anniversary celebration of the Pine Street Inn the other night.
Yeah.
What's the name of that incredible priest who spoke? Father John Rooney from St. Cecilia. He was so... How did he refer to the hierarchy of the church
in
his speech?
He said we've had some problems with the parent company.
The parent company is that... He was just so inspired. He was brilliant.
That's wonderful. I'm going to Mass on Tuesday evening Mass. Yep. I'm going to St. Cecilia's Church.
Oh, that's his church.
That's right.
Why Tuesday?
Oh, because I'm going to get with him and a couple of other priests.
Oh, terrific. And talk because I really want to,
since I'm always bashing and stuff, I need to come in here and say some good things.
Good.
And so I figured, in memory of Sister Irene, she would like to know that I'm going to evening Mass. And being attentive too.
Wow! And you're going to go with John Ooney and hear him talk, and you're going to talk?
No, I'm not going to talk. I'm going to believe it or not. I'm going to listen.
Oh, okay.
You know what they're showing?
Okay.
Law and Order SUV.
There you go.
Following the service. Exactly.
Those pedophilic priests.
I can't get enough.
Nice to see you. Terrible.
We should come over to each other's on those days.
Absolutely. Okay. We should. Okay, Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Irene's a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston voice of Detour's African-American Heritage Trail, and a visiting researcher in Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett G. Price III is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. They're also the hosts of the All Revved Up podcast, which comes out every other Wednesday, and it's really terrific. Go to allrevvedup.org to subscribe. Coming up, air pollution could be more hazardous to our health than we think. WGBH reporter Craig LaMalt joins us for that next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And not all air pollution is equal. The kind that's related to transportation, like the kind of air pollution you're inhaling near airports and highways, is particularly bad. It can even cause heart attacks and strokes. Why this is and who this is afflicting or affecting is the focus of GBH's Craig LaMalt's three-part series, which you can find online at WGBHnews.org. Craig, it's great to see you, and congratulations on it.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. So what did you do? Tell people.
Well, basically, I found out that a lot of the universities in this area were studying this one particular kind of air pollution. It's particulate matter air pollution that comes from cars and it comes from planes. And there is larger particles that are actually regulated and called PM2.5. They're 2.5 microns. But there's these tiny, tiny particles, ultra-fine particles they're called, that have no regulation whatsoever. And they're coming out of tailpipes, they're coming out of planes, and we are breathing them in. We're exposed to them, especially for people who live along highways and people who live close to the airport are breathing this stuff in. And the point of them being so small, that the reason that's so nasty is that they don't just get stuck in the lungs. They can get right into the bloodstream. And they're, you know, there's an inflammatory response, and they're, as you mentioned, they contribute to things like heart attack and stroke, cardiovascular disease.
And are they not regulated purely because of size? Is that the notion?
That is actually the point. So there are regulations for tiny air particles, but they're determined by mass, the amount of mass of these things. But these are so tiny that they don't have much mass. They weigh almost nothing, so there's none of the regulations really address them in any way. And so that's why a lot of the research is focused on this.
You know, I have to say, when I was listening to your thing, I'm saying to myself, can it get any dumber than this? The issue to me, I know nothing about science, so I assume you disabuse me of my comment in a second. The issue should not be the size of the problem creating thing. Mm-hmm. The issue should be what problem do they create? And if it turns out that it's clear that it's not just your lungs, which would be bad enough if that was as far as it went, but because of their size, as you say, they're able to get in your bloodstream and all that sort of thing. Why would they not be regulated?
Right. Well, I mean, I think part of the issue there is that it's relatively new science. So the regulation on the PM2.5, those larger particles, has been around for a while. But the researchers, the scientists, have been looking into this more and more and discovering that possibly the most dangerous kind of particles are these little tiny ones. And because our regulations sort of are based around mass, like these little guys kind of fall through the cracks, if you will.
You know, I was just saying to Craig when he came in, for 30 years I worked at the Boston Herald, which is the intersection of the Mass Pike in 993. Mm-hmm. I never thought about this. I never thought about the fact that, right, I wonder I'm not dead, Jim. I could keel over at any moment here.
Well, but you know, not only had you not thought about it, but when I'm reading your thing, putting aside Logan for a minute, which obviously is a special deal, we'll talk about that in a second,
yeah,
about it getting worse the closer it is to a location with great transportation density.
Yes.
Is what we're told when we discuss housing is the best place to build housing is where there is the greatest amount of transportation so that you have ability to get around. You may not have to use a car, that sort of thing. So how do those two things not run into each other? Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, and I'm glad you brought it up, because part of the point is that the communities that are closest to the highways are the ones that are most impacted. And a lot of the research, actually, there's some research done at Boston University looking at the economics of it. And lower income communities tend to have a much disproportionately higher exposure to this stuff, oftentimes because they live closer to highways.
So highways is compared to, for example, mass something like subway stops or those sort of things.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're looking at like the above ground ones, actually, I guess sort of the T mostly electrified, right? But trains do emit this sort of stuff as well. So it's not just cars. It is also things like trains. But if you are closer to those things, you have a higher exposure. And the lower income communities tend to be closer to the highways for two reasons, right? Because it's lower, it's more affordable to live there, but also because we have a history of putting highways through low income communities. So they have a disproportionate impact. But you're right that a lot of the new development is being proposed or built along the highways. And the hope is, I mean, that those new buildings have the necessary filtration, right? They have HVAC systems that are filtering out some of this stuff. They're built so that they don't have open windows opening up right over the highways. So I think a lot of the newer stuff that's actually being built, you know, luxury condos and things like that, probably is addressing this kind of air pollution.
Unlike a public school or public housing, yeah, which you talk
exactly
about in your reporting.
Yeah, tell us about Old Colony in South Boston.
Yeah, so
Gary
Ademkowitz at Harvard University did a study looking at the Old Colony housing complex, and it was a great study because old colonies being redeveloped over time. So there are older units and there are newer units. And he was able to compare the particulate matter in the older units and inside and the particulate matter in the newer units. And this actually, I should clarify, he was looking at PM 2.5, the larger particles, mm-hmm. not ultrafines. But it's the same general idea that the newer units had far less air pollution, far, far less air pollution than the older ones. And in fact, they found that children in these buildings, when they were in the new units, they had fewer asthma attacks. And in general, they were healthier in the newer units. And that's because the newer units were designed without windows that open up over the roadway. They had HVAC systems that filtered the air. So you can do things to take this into account. You mentioned the schools. In Chinatown, there's a number of schools right along the highway, the Josiah Quincy Upper School and Lower School. The upper school has no central HVAC system. And the headmaster of the school said, when it's hot out, the teachers just open up the windows. So this stuff is just getting into the classrooms. And they are building a new upper school there. And I talked to the architect who said they're going to take this into account. But it's going to be years before that's built, and then the lower school.
Right on the Mass Pike, right?
Yeah, right on the Mass Pike, and it's Chinatown.
Where everybody is congested.
Exactly. In fact, Chinatown has among the worst air quality in the Commonwealth, and that's because of the location, next to the Pike, and also 93. It's pretty much right there as well. So, there are things that can be done to address that, and that's part of the series is talking to people about what can we do to actually make this a little bit better.
Before we get to what we can do, I wanted to know whether or not I should believe the Massport's Director of Aviation Planning and Strategy. You talked to Flavio Leo,
yeah,
who says that Christopher Muther wrote something the other day. We're about to be the 10th busiest airport in the country, in part, I guess, because of a couple things. One, because JetBlue and Delta are in this mm-hmm. competition to add flights. And two, there's an expansion like Terminal E. Leo, this guy at Massport's contention is the expansion of Terminal E, which is supposed to be finished in 3 years, is actually going to reduce air pollution. But because since there are more gates, there'll be less idling or whatever they call it for
yep.
planes. That, to me, seems to make sense.
Yep.
But it also means volume is going up, which would offset the good part of the no idling. Would it not? I mean, is Logan moving up? I think we were 17th 2 years ago. I think we're 15th last year. We're going to be 10th, I think, by 2022. It would seem to me, despite what this guy is saying, that that means bad news, does it not?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, if we continue to see more and more and more planes, we're just going to see more and more and more of this kind of pollution. Because, with the cars, we can have, and hopefully will see, an increase in electric vehicles, right, that aren't putting out this kind of pollution. Mm-hmm. No electric planes yet. We're
not
going to see that.
Are they even thinking about this? Are they thinking about the Green New Deal over there at Logan and every place else?
Well, I mean, what can they do to some degree, right? We need to have planes coming in and out. We've all taken them, right?
Greta Thunberg doesn't need a plane coming in and out.
Well, I mean, to this point, trains, you put out this kind of pollution as well, but I think less of it than planes do, I don't think if you live next to a train track, you're going to see quite the same kind of pollution that you would living near an airport or living near a highway. But it is a problem. And I think maybe what I was most struck by when I talked to Flavio Leo, I think maybe when I went to him and I asked him about this, I expected them to say, no, don't worry about this. This is not a problem. We're fine. But he didn't say that. He said, we are also concerned about this kind of air pollution. We acknowledge that this is an issue and we want to address it. And they are working with the researchers. They're providing flight data information so that they can compare, because the researchers are measuring the air pollution when planes go over, and they're comparing it to the data what was the elevation, what was the speed and the wind and all these things. So Massport is working with the researchers, and what he said was, I hope this research informs a national policy about what we can do around this, and then we will actually at that point be able to do something with it. So it's not tomorrow. It's a ways off. But they did the same kind of thing with the noise pollution, right? They've gone around and worked in 11,000 homes. They've done noise remediation. They've put in new windows and things like that. So there is a model for them going home to home.
How are they doing on the shaken remediation? Yeah. You go in these homes of Winthrop, the players come over and the china's vibrating across the table.
When you think about in addition to all of the scariness of being on a plane, you're also putting out all kinds of invisible stuff that's even scarier.
We're talking to Craig LaMalt from WGBH's series on ultrafine particles is something else to worry about, like we don't have enough to begin with. So what is, other than individual projects, which are being built in ways, hopefully some of them built in ways that make them more immune to these ultrafine particles, is there a big solution? I mean, aren't we part of this multi-state coalition in New England thing?
Exactly.
Does that have anything to do with this?
Yeah,
no?
Absolutely.
What's
because,
going on with that?
Because that's about reducing the kind of emissions from these cars, right? And if you reduce the emissions from the cars, you're going to reduce this kind of pollution. But again, that's...
Well, wait, how is that happening when Donald Trump is vetoing, or whatever the appropriate verb is, even California's attempt to have higher emission standards, better right. emission standards, and at least he's attempting. How do we in New England, or what is it, 8 states or whatever number of states?
I think that's right. Yeah.
How can we, as a group, do better than what the feds are doing?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because even though right now the standards that so. The Trump administration has revoked the California's waiver to do its own air pollution standard, which is a more strict standard than the national one. Even that, those standards, what we're talking about there, address greenhouse gas emissions. So they don't actually really deal with particulate matter. However, if California, if Massachusetts, if other states wanted to enact new ultrafine particle standards based on this new research, this new understanding about the danger of it, they can't do that now because...
Cannot do it now.
Yes, because it's the same thing. They're basically prevented from enacting stricter standards than the federal standards. So that's a real issue. I mean, Massachusetts and the other states can do things to try to encourage, like, fewer cars. They can increase, public transport, things like that. And I think a lot of that is what is going to happen in that state compact. But in terms of enacting specific regulations about the emissions of ultrafine particles, right now, that's an issue. Of course, Attorney General Maura Healey and the other states have sued the Trump administration over that decision. And
the California decision.
Yeah, and we're just going to have to see how that plays out.
But is there anything being contemplated as relates to these ultrafine particles? Is that the term of art, by the way? Is that how they describe it?
Well, so it's particulate matter. The ultrafines are those tiniest ones.
Okay, so the ultrafines, really, yeah. Is there anything being contemplated on the federal level or no?
There was an EPA advisory committee that is basically the group that looks into these sorts of things and would be there to recommend kinds of regulations like this. That group was disbanded in October by the EPA under Scott Pruitt's leadership.
Figures. One last thing.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything about medicine here, but I'm wondering if you happen to have found out in the course of your reporting whether there's anything medically that people think they've lived under in Winthrop or wherever underneath these airport runways. Can they go see if they have particles in their blood, or is it not that sophisticated?
There is research that is looking into the particulate matter, and in fact, particularly around Winthrop, actually, the people at the Olin College of Engineering are going house to house. They're putting these kind of air filters, or not filters, but the air sort of sensors in people's yards, and a lot of the research is actually testing blood content as well. So, I mean, this research is being done by Olin College of Engineering, Harvard, Tufts, and BU, and they're all mentioned in the series, which is on WGBHnews.org, with links to the researchers' information. So if people are concerned about this, I think the researchers would like to talk to them about it. One thing we didn't mention, I want to make sure we get to, is that there are air filters that can address this kind of particulate matter pollution. Freestanding units, you plug them in, you put them in your home, and they can filter out, if it's the right size filter and it's an enclosed space where maybe you're sleeping, they can filter out 85% of these particles. So they're called HEPA filters, H-E-P-A, and
they have those for vacuum cleaners too, don't they?
Right.
How expensive are these filters?
I think you can get them for, a few $100s. And I think if it's a bigger space, you're going to need a bigger filter, so it's going to have a bigger price tag. But it is something. If you're within, it's really the main concern around the highways is 150 to 200 meters from the roadway. If you're further than that, it drops off tenfold. So it's really how close are you to those highways? And in fact, in the first story in our series, there is an interactive map that shows what the area of concern around all the highways are. If you're outside of that, it's less of a concern, but you still might want to consider having one of these air filters.
Craig, thanks so
much. Thank you very
much. Congratulations on your work, too.
Thank you. And you can catch Craig's three-part series on transportation-related air pollution at WGBHnews.org. Craig Lemoultness, by the way, it's LEMOULT. Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Up next, love is in the air. The Boston Globe's Meredith Goldstein is here to talk about season 3 of her hit podcast, Love Letters. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marge Regan. So in season 3 of her hit podcast, Meredith Goldstein is aiming to ask one really tough question. How do you know when you found the one? She's not talking about who to vote for in 2020. She's talking about something much harder. She's trying to find the answer to the question, when do you know you really love someone? When do you know you want to spend the rest of your life with someone? And when do you know when it's time to leave? It's called Love Letters. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts or go directly to loveletters.boston.com. Meredith is a lifestyle and entertainment writer and Love Letters advice columnist for the Boston Globe. She also writes books. Her latest is the young adult novel, Chemistry Lessons. Meredith, it's great to see you.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, congratulations, too, on your great success with this podcast and, of course, the column in general. But, okay, how do you know?
How do you know?
Give us some tips.
Well, you know, obviously this is a very broad question, and we're hearing very different answers to it. In our first episode, we hear from a touring musician who compares his wife to his dog and his condo. And that might sound very unromantic, comparing your spouse to your dog. But what he was really saying was, when I'm with my wife, I know I'm home. When I break from tour, you know, when I see my dog in my house, I know I'm home. So that's like one way that I liked, you know, does this person feel like home? But everybody has a different way of explaining it. And I'm trying to get to the bottom of like, well, how do we know? And even, you know, inversely, how do we know when to go? And how do we know when to not commit to someone for life?
I saw you on the CBS, whatever it is,
yes,
with Liam Martin. And you
he
say
was cute.
One of the, he's a terrific, I really, I'm a fan of his, actually.
Yeah,
I think he's great.
He's very sweet.
But in addition, you also, one of the questions, they're not just all the huge ones, even though this one might be a huge one. You mentioned to him that one of the things you address this season is, how do you know when it's time to get a tattoo?
Yes.
With the name of your partner-to-be or your
yes.
partner on it?
I mean, there's so many how do you know questions. Getting a tattoo, which I will never do because I do not like pain. But that is one of them, right? Where I thought, how do you know when somebody's like worth the name? And I always think about these like famous people I read about where they have to like redo a tattoo to look like something entirely different. I mean, I remember Johnny Depp when I was a kid. He had, you know, Winona Forever for Winona Ryder. And then he changed it to Wino Forever. Because, like, what do you do, right? So, but, you know, so many tattoo artists tell me, like, don't do it. It is a bad luck thing.
Yeah.
Which cracks me up. Like, if you want to doom your relationship.
Do you cover how do you know when you should do a prenup this season or no?
We do get into finances. So that's going to be our third episode where it's like, how do you know how to deal with money and how to share a bank account? And in it, one of the people I interview is my sister, who I like to have as a special guest because she is the unfiltered version of me. And she admits that her husband has no idea half of like how she deals with her money. And so many couples keep things separate. So many couples combine. So we don't get into prenups as much as how much should you know about a partner's finances and when is it okay to just like share that bank account.
And how do you answer that question?
I mean, it's difficult to be honest about that kind of thing, but you have to be, right? Even if the honesty is about saying, we're going to keep this separate, and here's how we're going to keep it separate. Because for some couples, especially if you get together older, you don't necessarily want to just like combine everything.
So we're talking to Love Letters advice columnist for the Boston Globe, Meredith Goldstein. Do you do the podcast the way you do your column, Tell People? Because in your column, of course, you have not only your answer to someone's dilemma, but you have
crowd
five or ten other readers.
The commenters.
Yeah, but it's great. It's such a brilliant idea. Did you come up with that idea, by the way?
Well, I mean, you know, I had no idea that the comment section in Life would become such a huge part of an online reading experience. Uh-huh. I certainly didn't think that 10 years later, the same people would be commenting for 10 years. So, I mean, I'm just very grateful that they show up every day. But for the podcast, it's much more of a narrative story. So, you know, we're in a room talking to people and we get many different voices, but they're all, you know, kind of on the record as themselves. So you're hearing many different voices, but without necessarily the Greek chorus of judgment.
You know, Meredith Goldstein from Love Letters, when I was listening to the trailer, there was, I think it was a woman, I forget because it was a couple of days ago, who was talking about, I guess the question was, how do you know when to leave? But also, how do you know how to divorce or when to divorce? And she's talking about some ceremony. Did I get this right? Where she and her soon-to-be former husband are on opposite sides of the pool or something. And they're about
story.
To dive into the damn pool or whatever.
So this is the first time I'd really been told about a divorce ceremony. And this was a couple that, you know, we'll hear from later in the season who got married. 3 years to the day of their marriage, they get divorced and they celebrate this by having a divorce ceremony by a friend's pool, and they both say wishes to each other for happy futures, and then they jump in the pool symbolically.
Like, so that they're sort of
like
one
baptism
for that brief moment kind of thing? Or
yeah, just sort of it was a celebratory moment of this didn't work out, but I wish the best for you. And this is a couple, they're still really close. And so it was figuring out that perhaps being married wasn't the right form, you know, for them, of their relationship.
So we get back to the threshold question, but how do you know that he or she is the one? So in one case, the person knew because the woman-to-be was like his dog. I mean, or whatever But that isn't like a universal kind of thing.
No, I mean, I'm allergic to dogs. That'll
never
work
for
me, right?
You, okay.
I mean, I think, you know, people describe it so many different ways, but yet there's the similarity. We talked to a woman who cancels her wedding at the last minute.
Oh, tell us that story.
Well, by the way, this is an expensive thing to do. And when she first tells her father, I'm going to cancel this wedding, he says, oh, no, you're not. And she tries to explain to him quickly, like, you know, it's actually more expensive to get divorced than it is to cancel a wedding.
And it's my wedding, not yours.
And it's my wedding, right? But everything was planned. The dress was purchased. The caterers were set up. But she talks about being in a church service, and this is not an overwhelmingly religious person, and feeling like it was a divine intervention. And she says she actually went Christmas tree shopping at one point with her soon-to-be in-laws. And when she pulls out of the parking lot, she thinks, I know, I just know, I will never see these people again. And this was after a long relationship. So that gut feeling of
we
like...
We need more information on this. How far away from the wedding was this?
Months. Months.
So like 6 months?
Yeah, about 6 months. Okay. And, you know, in wedding land, that's pretty close to a wedding.
Yeah, because you put the deposit down and all that kind of stuff.
People know. Save the dates are out. So, you know, you got to trust your gut.
But is that the common thread? Because when I was touching on the dog thing a minute ago, I was going to say that doesn't apply to most people, it doesn't apply to you, as you said a minute ago. But are there, in any one of the huge questions, like how do you know he or she is the one? How do you know that this is over? Are there common threads, or is every single one unique? Or
I think they're all unique, but how they describe that feeling of intuition, it winds up feeling similar. Like they can't let it go. They can't let that feeling go. And I like to say that just from doing love letters for 10 years, I feel like there's an inherent fear of missing out that humans have. So many letters I get are about like, well, I'm married, but what if I'm missing something else, right? And if your fear of missing out is missing out on the person, like you can't imagine missing out on that person. Like that's a good way to know.
So let me ask you about something that you just wrote that I thought was really a great bit of advice. Writing letters to an ex-person in your life. You talked about that. Tell us about that.
Well, I think that one of the things I wanted to focus on this year is unsent letters. And I have this project with Esther Perel where who's a relationship counselor and quite wonderful, and I'm very enamored with her and just in life. And we solicited people for their unsent letters. And that could mean to an ex, to a current partner, just letters they wrote and never sent. And we got a bunch of letters, and they're so cool because they're like diary entries, right? Like people you know, putting their wishes into words and never quite sending them. And I actually think it was therapeutic for the letter writers to send it to us. So I happen to think that even if you know you'll never send it, if you've got something to say to somebody, write it down first in the form of a letter, because I think it can get you there.
But you talked about doing this yourself.
Oh,
and
I
being
did.
Rescued by
I did.
A friend.
I wrote. I was dumped so many years ago. Email was new, I think. And I wrote a letter to an ex-boyfriend begging him to take me back. And I quoted the Backstreet Boys in it. This is not something I'm proud of. And I guarantee you it was during a year that this made more sense. And I showed it to a friend before I sent it. And he said, it's lovely that you wrote it. Now put it away and never send it. And I actually didn't need to, because just by writing the letter, I got it all out of my system.
You know, I'm sure we've asked you this before, Meredith Goldstein, but I don't remember the answer. How did this thing – I didn't realize it was 10 years till you just said it.
10 years.
How did this – whose concept was this?
I mean, I can't take credit for inventing advice column, certainly not. But for the Globe, having a local in-house advice column, yeah. I mean,
who was that? Was it you?
That was
did
me.
You propose
now,
it?
I wanted, yes, I absolutely did. But we were already running Margo Howard, who is Dear Margo.
We
and
love
who, and
Margo
we all,
Howard,
I know the three
the
of us love Margo.
She's great.
And Margo had a national readership. And I just thought I could do this little advice column internally in the Globe where it would just be Boston readers, because Boston cares a lot about Boston. So I felt like, you know, if I got a letter that signed Board and Braintree, people would be like that much more interested. So, yeah, we started it. And I had no idea that 10 years later it would still be going. And Margo always says, like, it's a good business to be in. People are always going to be a little bit miserable, which is.
And also, where did the idea come from to have the chorus of commenters?
Well, that, yeah, I really said, you know, Boston.com was newer then, but I thought, well, we have all these people weighing in on Red Sox games and Patriots games. What if I said, what do you think about this person's love problem? And turns out people have opinions.
By the way, beyond Margo Howard's history in the area that you mentioned, if you are someone who is not dramatically enamored of Donald Trump, you might want to read Margo's Twitter feed.
Oh, yeah. She's got opinions.
It is relentless. So are you different in your job, in this job, 10 years in than you were?
I think I'm more forgiving, and I think I'm more open to marriage and commitment. I mean, not for myself, but for other for other people. I think that, you know, I used to think it was incredibly brave to be single, because I am single. And now I realize how much bravery there is when it comes to being in a relationship. Like, it takes a lot of bravery to stay with someone.
Are you anxious when you're giving... I mean, you're respectful of... You're ridiculously... I shouldn't say ridiculous. You're very respectful,
I'm pretty respectful
of people who ask for your advice. But do you not feel some burden in giving... I mean, these are the most intimate, important things in people's lives. They're inviting you in, so they're the initiator. But do you feel anxiety?
Well, now I do. Thanks a lot.
No, but do you?
No, I mean, I feel grateful. I definitely feel like my tone suggests that, you know, we're just talking about it. I'm not going to give you a final answer that you have to stick to. But, you know, I just never want to take it for granted. But I don't sit around feeling anxious about it. I mean, I think you have to be a little bit opinionated and bossy to do this kind of job. So that part of me, you know, wins out.
You know, the podcast before was centered on breakups.
Yes.
And that was season one, right? Yes.
Season one, and two was how to meet someone.
How to meet, right.
And you had something, and I think this is a great idea, because I remember interviewing somebody that was a mental health counselor, and they said, among teenagers, one of the biggest reasons of total meltdown among teenagers is breakups.
Yep.
And you wrote a piece that was talking about how you really need to go to a breakup summit.
Well, so the Boston Public Health Commission, and I have to give them a lot of credit, they hold a breakup summit for teens every summer, and it teaches them how to break up. And, you know, some people laugh at this, and then they stop laughing and say, oh, adults should get this too, right? Learning how to accept rejection is such a big part of public health in general, because when we see all of these, like, horrible crimes committed, so often we can trace them to domestic violence, to someone feeling like they're not owed the personal relationship they've asked for, right? So we're never told how absolutely awful it feels to not get what you want in love. So I love that Boston is taking this on as a public health issue. And I really wish that everybody got a lesson of, like, hey, it's going to feel terrible, and here's what you can do with those terrible feelings. You know, I think we'd have a lot less problems with violence.
Did you have to get advice, calmness, relationship breakup training? Did you have to go to, like, study this?
I don't think I needed to study because I'd been dumped so many times. I mean, I was
an
expert at how to take rejection.
Well, you know, neither did Ann Landers or Dear Abby or Beth Winship that used to do that with the Globe when the Winships when Winship was editor of the Globe. And I think Ann Landers, for me, who was in my hometown paper, who's Margot's mother, was huge in my life because she talked about all these things, and this, of course, is long before the internet, but she talked about all these things with kind of a common sense, very generous, warm approach.
And there's a reason that all of these advice columnists are generally reporters and people who are sort of out in the world but opinionated, as opposed to therapists who are doing therapy jobs. And you know, that's not what we're doing.
Yeah. So am I right that there are two episodes that have dropped so far in season three?
Two, and then a third next week.
And how many are in the season?
10 with some bonus episodes.
So, So what else, how do you know? Finish the sentence.
Well,
are you doing?
How do you know when you're in an arranged marriage that you know? So what does it mean to know that someone is the one when you've chosen them in a different way and it's that person might be chosen for you? One is about how do you know when to convert for a partner?
Religion.
Yes. And so we talked to someone who is now a nice Jewish boy and how he became that way and why he became that way. So, there's so much. How do you know when it's more than friends or when you should remain friends?
What's the answer to that one?
Oh, it's very complicated. I don't want to give anything away. But the best one of my favorites is how do you know when to sleep with someone?
And?
Ooh.
I mean, I wish there was like one right answer, but we do get really into the research of it all and whether, you know, physical intimacy can inhibit a good relationship or add to a relationship. So, again, there's never one right answer, but sometimes there kind of is. So,
remember when Harry met Sally, how when they were friends for all those years and they finally went to bed together, it caused a total breakdown.
It did.
In the relationship.
And I always laugh about that movie because I think I thought they were so much older and now I'm probably 10 years older than those characters and they were so worried and they were in their early 30s.
Yeah, I know. So it's 10 episodes each season and we're in the third season now.
Third season now.
And if people want to listen to them, where do they go?
They can go to boston.com/loveletters and click on podcast. But the easier way is loveletters.show.
Loveletters.show.
Yes.
And how much, this is a very time consuming thing. You've got to write the column and do the podcast.
I never get sick of hearing about love problems.
It is really, it is really
fun. Talking about time. We do 3 hours
of you guys
radio
are like,
live a day.
You live in the studio, I think,
so
right?
So how has this impacted your personal life with your friends? I mean, is everybody asking you advice now all the time or do they?
I mean, I think my friends know what I don't know. Hopefully they'll keep it a secret. I think it's made me feel like I owe my readers and listeners to be a little bit more brave in my own life. So I am very happy living vicariously, but I've thought more recently, you know, like all these people are so brave, they're like getting out there and maybe I should watch 2% less TV.
Yeah.
Just only two, though.
Do you have any favorites in this genre?
In terms of
advice columnists?
I'm a Margot fan forever. You know, it's funny. Since I started writing an advice column, I read a lot less of them because I read so many love problems all day. But I will say that the anecdote to reading love problems all day is to read romance novels. So I did not become an avid romance novel reader until I started doing the column because everybody gets a happily ever after.
Oh,
and that's a wonderful way to balance.
Who's your favorite romance
writer? Gosh. There are so many I love. I wrote something in the Globe on Sunday about the Regency romance novelists I love, so you can look that
up. Well, since she's going a little bit off love letters, can I for a second?
Yes.
All three of us saw David Byrne.
Yes.
And it's horrible to talk about something that's already gone, but you can go to Broadway.
You can go to Broadway.
Yeah, it's worth every cent.
Did you think it was as brilliant as we did?
I thought it was brilliant.
I saw it last week. Marjorie saw it, I think, on Friday.
Yep. And
I thought it was brilliant, and I think I tweeted this, but it was the first time in a long time that I forgot I had a phone. Like for 3 hours, I just was in the moment and present in the moment. And, you know, what a beautiful theater and a beautiful performance to be in it. Made me want to buy a David Byrne suit.
I know.
They're all wearing the same suit.
Everybody looks good in a gray suit.
Barefoot.
Yeah, barefoot. They got to clean that stage every night really well,
I guess
assume.
They do. And the band itself was absolutely fantastic.
You know, from the music, and by the way, a lot of it, for those who don't know, it's not, there's some Talking Head stuff, but a lot of contemporary stuff from American Utopia, after which, obviously.
It's a great that's Christmas called. Present.
Great choreography, fabulous musicians, great stage. It was almost perfect. I mean, it was just brilliant.
And in that moment, I was thinking, how lucky am I to live in Boston, where we get so much of this first? So that's right. Before Broadway.
Well, we're getting Plaza Suite, too, coming in February, just for a few weeks. Anyway, Meredith Goldstein, congratulations.
Season, thank you.
Meredith Goldstein is a lifestyle and entertainment writer and the Love Letters Advice columnist for the Boston Globe. She also writes books, and her latest is the young adult novel, Chemistry Lessons. Meredith is the host of Love Letters Podcast. Season 3 dropped last week. You can find it at loveletters.com.
.show.
Or loveletters.show.
Or on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts.
Okay, loveletters.show. Excuse me. We are done. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can always find us, by the way, of our own podcast on iTunes, Boston Public Radio Podcast. Tomorrow we'll be at the Boston Public Library. Sports Authority Trenny Kuznarek will be there. Frontline's Martin Smith on his new documentary about the Saudi crown prince. CNN's John King and the latest on impeachment. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeli, Aidan Conley, our engineer, John the Claw Parker. What's on TV?
Well, one of the highest ranking Democrats in the House of Representatives, Catherine Clark, is going to join me, obviously, to talk about impeachment, where we are and where we are going. Speaking of the Globe, Nestor Ramos wrote with his colleagues this brilliant, scary piece about Cape Cod and the impact of climate change. Nestor is going to join me, as is State Senator Julian Sear, so that we can talk about not just the problem, but potentially solutions. Jared's got a package as well, and I've got a commentary on your favorite thing, the Catholic Church. It's all tonight at 7 o'clock, Greater Boston.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow, and have a great afternoon.